Before we begin the proceedings, I'd like to invite Mr. Tony Barzalato, who is the Chief of Security Services, and he will give you a security briefing regarding the United Nations. Mr. Barzalato, please. Welcome, sir.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Tony Barzalato, Safety Inspector here at the United Nations. On behalf of Security and Safety, welcome. I want to ask everybody, when you walked into the room here, by a show of hands, be honest now, how many people looked to try to locate where the exits were? Well, unfortunately, not everybody raised their hand. Well, here's a, let's call it a homework assignment for you. Whether you come to the United Nations, or you go to a restaurant, you go to a mall, you go to a hotel, the very first thing you need to do is you need to locate the exits. And I didn't say exit, I said exits. The world that we live in, as you know, has changed. We could have a fire at any given moment. We could have an active shooter come in. We could have a terrorist event. And if you don't know ahead of time where the exits are, it could be, you could become what's known as a statistic. And that's not just for you, that's for your family members, your friends, everybody. That's what you should do ahead of time. Now, with that said, let's point out the exits in this temporary General Assembly Hall. To my left, certainly the door that you walked in. There's a door directly down the hallway from that. They will lead you into a corridor. You can make a right and go directly outside, or go left and go outside the door that you came in this morning. Directly behind you, there's a series of doors that will take you directly outside. And to my right, that similar type of corridor. But the corridor here, you can literally just walk across the corridor, go to another set of doors, and you'll be outside. In the event that the fire alarm activates while you're here at the UN, there's three options that could take place. First of all, if the fire alarm activates and there's no message, everybody's going to be asked to get up and calmly and quickly exit the room. If there's a message that tells you to stand by while we investigate, that's exactly what we want you to do. And the third option may be we're going to relocate you somewhere else to the complex. The UN is six city blocks long, so there's many dungeons, I mean many rooms we can take you to keep you safe and secure. Okay? Your safety and security is our number one concern today. But please, follow the instructions. We have the best security force in the world here to be able to help facilitate if we have to evacuate for whatever the case. And of course, you know, there's something that may be happening out on First Avenue, and we want you to be safer here in this complex. So just follow the instructions given, okay? How many people smoke? How many people are not telling the truth? I'm glad nobody smokes, so I don't have to go through my routine with smoking. But if you are, you do need to smoke, you're going to have to go out to the rear of the North Lawn building. There's a little smokers area that we have you smoking out there, okay? Well, again, on behalf of Security and Safety, welcome to the UN. Hope your stay is enjoyable. If we can do anything for you, please let us know. Thanks for your cooperation and listening to me. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Barzalato. Really appreciate this. So, once again, a very warm welcome to all of you. As my friend just said, it is your UN, and we are so thrilled and excited to have you here. And I'm going to invite people who are on the south side there, or rather west side, if you can please come closer. That'll be a little easier for you to see and listen to the proceedings. We are here today based on a six-month journey we started along with some wonderful people who came to us and said, we want to support the UN's mission in ways which has not been done before. We want to engage people who are innovators, who are doing great things in the area of science, life sciences, health, and having a positive impact to society. We also want to bring family offices and foundations to the table so they can listen and be inspired by this process. And I'm so grateful and honored to have friends, and I'm going to invite them up to the podium, actually, Alex Charlton, Michael Moffat, Jonathan Sack here, and Tony Kuhn. Where's Tony as well? Please come. You are here because of the passion and commitment of these four wonderful people. Welcome. I also want you to know that should you need to increase your credit line, they'll also do that for you. Please feel free to reach out to any of us if you need anything. We are here to help to make your stay as comfortable as possible and an enriching experience to the United Nations. Thank you. There are a number of volunteers here who you've met as you came in, and needless to say, you might have other questions. Please do approach them. So, the Global Health Impact Summit. One of the biggest issues facing the United Nations and facing society is the lack of access to proper healthcare. Lack of, if you like, wider use of information and communications technology, which can transfer that information and make it readily available to society, especially in developing countries. The other challenge, of course, is how do you train people? How do you train nurses, frontline health workers, etc.? How do you monitor patients? All of these challenges are being addressed one way or another by different parts of the United Nations system, led by the World Health Organization, in some cases, International Telecommunication Union, others, UNICEF, UNDP, etc. So there are a number of organizations doing these things over the globe. Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, and in fact, if you go back to the previous Secretary General, Kofi Annan, insisted that we just cannot continue by working in silos, that we cannot do it alone. We need to engage all the actors. We need to engage them in non-traditional ways where we can learn from the leadership role of the private sector, the delivery systems of NGOs, whilst the UN sets public policy. So to do these things, collaboration is key. So today, our goal is for you to learn from each other. You can offer a lot to the United Nations. We also invite you to partner with the United Nations. There are ways you'll be able to do so, and you'll learn from that from my colleagues. And as you know, the forum has come together as a result of the leadership role of Cavendish Global with a number of critical partners working with us. And I want to start by thanking my friend, colleague, I wish I could say mentor because I'm older than him, is Ellis Rubinstein, who is the president and CEO of the New York Academy of Sciences. Ellis reminds me, he says, Amir, do I really need to work with the bureaucracy? He's very agile in terms of his initiatives, which he does in the science he works on. And we're so grateful, Ellis, that you are here. You're a huge supporter. You will see an entire day has been developed under the leadership of the New York Academy of Sciences. And we are honored to have you here, sir. We are also very grateful to the International Telecommunication Union. I am privileged to be associated with the ITU. I graduated from the UN in 2010. But you never graduate. I have UN blue blood in here. I had blood transfusion. So I'm privileged to work with Dr. Hamadou Touré, who is the Secretary General of ITU. And they do a number of things in terms of using technology to take a quantum leap in society. And you'll hear more shortly. And I want to also acknowledge my dear friend, Roland Rich. Roland runs the UN Office for Partnerships, which focuses on doing exactly that, is to help others come together in a light touch way to do great things together. And Roland is always, he's also executive director of the UN Democracy Fund, which he set up way back in 2005, 2006, and He's an expert in many things, and you'll hear him. He's also a very funny speaker. I'm very grateful to the Department of Economic and Social Affairs. By the way, you'll see that tomorrow you're in the ECOSOC chamber, which is the Economic and Social Council, one of the six organs of the United Nations. You will be in that room. We were supposed to be there, but then they felt that it would be more exciting experience for you to start the meeting in the UN General Assembly Hall. That's why you start here and then you go to the ECOSOC chamber. Some of you might have seen a different ECOSOC chamber when you see it on TV, etc. That is under repairs, so that's why you'll see the room is quite large. It can accommodate 1,200 people altogether. And for that, I'm very thankful to Thomas Gass, who, by the way, has just flown in. And he's got his carrier bag and everything here. He came directly to the meeting. But I've left the best to the last, is Undersecretary General Gyan Acharya. He's the Undersecretary General for, now this is, his title is High Representative for Least Developed Countries, Landlocked Countries, and Small Island Development States. I hope I have not missed out any other of your territories, sir. The UN has 193 member states. Mr. Acharya probably controls 192 of them. He looks after the development policies, development leadership needed for those countries, the least developed, landlocked countries, and small island development states. And we are so honored to have him here to give the keynote speech and to welcome you all. And he will give you some exciting ideas to partner with us. So welcome, sir. Good to have you.
First of all, let me begin by thanking Mr. Emil Ossal, Chairman of the Global Partnership Forum, as well as my distinguished co-panelists and many of the participants for a wonderful program. I must say I welcome this initiative, and I welcome you all and commend all the organizers for putting a great deal of time and energy into this undertaking. It is my sincere hope that this is the beginning of further deliberations that will help leverage the contributions of the private sector and foundations to the fulfillment of goals and objectives of the United Nations, particularly in the area of global health today. The areas that we are trying to cover in post-2015 development agenda, if you look at all of that, you know, from the human and social development, economic growth and structural transformation, including infrastructure and the ICTs and all of that, but also the sustainability of the entire efforts, whether it is economic, whether it is human and social development, and the protection of the natural capital requires widest possible partnership and collaboration of all. So I think this meeting fits in very well with all the things that we are going to talk about, and we are going to take it forward in the post-2015 development period. The theme of this particular forum is very closely related to the needs and concerns of the three groups of countries under the purview of my office, which our good friend Amit Ossal said is a bit of a tongue twister, but again, this is what I would say. These are the countries which are at the bottom of development ladder when you look at the overall development perspective. In terms of per capita income, in terms of the human and social development, and also in terms of the ability to withstand internal and external shocks. And therefore, I think what we are really trying to look at, my office is working together with all of them in the policy areas, but also trying to make sure that their issues are firmly integrated in the global policy agenda. When you look at the, you know, the framework of the MDGs, we believe that it triggered, you know, the global attention and action to addressing the sources of human deprivation. With less than 2 years to the target date, the humanity as a whole has reached the MDG targets of having extreme poverty and the proportion of people without access to safe drinking water. Also, the world is within the striking distance of achieving the hunger reduction and a number of other targets. We are glad that even in LDCs and other countries, vulnerable countries, there has been a remarkable progress in the health sectors, thanks to the national focus in these countries, but also a very strong support from all the, you know, the partners that you represent here, the global multi-stakeholder support. Yet much remains to be done. This overall picture also conceals varied level of performances and the daunting challenges that these countries, and especially those which are like least developed countries and the countries in conflict, face. We have to further accelerate our work, and we have to do more with, while consistently making sure that these countries do not fall back on their progress for want of support and cooperation. Talking about some of the health-related issues, if you look at the child mortality rates, they are also declining in most of the least developed countries, but the speed at which this occurs is far below what is required to achieve the Millennium Development Goals target of 2/3 reduction from 1990 levels. As a result, average under 5 child mortality in these countries is estimated at 85 deaths per 1,000 live births in 2012, almost still today the double of even the other developing countries. So there is a long way to go in terms of the progress that we need to make. The same also holds true for the maternal mortality rate, which is not being reduced by 3/4, but is still by about half. So we have a long way to go to reach our goals and sustain it over the period. We are glad that there has been a strong support from the government, the private sector, and the philanthropic organizations to the UN Secretary General's Every Woman and Every Child initiative to give high priority to this sector. Better health outcomes are not only fundamental human rights, but also lack of it affects the activities of the society, including economic growth and development and the long-term sustainability of the nation. It would be a great waste of human, valuable human resources, which is a prerequisite, in fact, for overall progress of the society. Therefore, we have to look at the issue of health and its cross-sectoral connections. In most LDCs, a significant share of the population live mostly in rural areas. They are also excluded from the health services because of the poor, you know, the transport facilities, lack of technological reach, and also, of course, the availability of the resources. Another example is that even when you look at the level of education, you know, the cross-sectoral and the inter-relationship with the other sectors, a great deal of evidence shows that the mortality rates are much higher among children of low-educated mothers than those of the more educated mothers. So we have to see the relationship between the education as well as the health. And then, of course, the affordability of such services, because extreme poverty is pervasive. The proportion of people who are turned away temporarily and from seeking health care because of their inability to pay because of poverty stands at a very high level. The situation is further compounded by limited health insurance coverage across the LDCs. The causation, as I said, also runs the other way around. Poor health outcomes reduce the stock of human capital, constrain productivity, and result in low incomes, pushing them into a poverty trap. Ladies and gentlemen, the private sector and foundations have developed many innovative solutions to address the binding constraints to improved health outcomes in LDCs and other developing countries. These solutions focus on improving, improving and developing viable community-based health insurance schemes, expanding immunization programs, improving health infrastructure. These interventions contribute in part to some of the progress made by these LDCs and other countries. In this regard, it is worth mentioning that much of the philanthropic aid, about half of the total flows, is channeled to health. Such aid is delivered through vertical funding on specific diseases, services, or interventions in the health sector. Anchored in private sector's practices, such funding targets interventions are deemed cost-effective with measurable impact. But we also know that for immediate effects, these interventions have proved effective. We have to work harder to make sure that there is coherence, which is also promoted, and especially that the national health system is strengthened so that the sustainability of the progress is ensured in the long run. Looking forward, the private sector and the foundations have much to offer. They are the repository of wealth and health-related solutions and ideas that have practical applications to LDCs. They are capable of tailoring these solutions to meet the particular needs of the LDCs, and they should be continuously encouraged to do so. Incentives should therefore be put in place through multi-stakeholder efforts. In this regard, We commend what foundations and other philanthropic organizations have already done. The level and modalities of the delivery of philanthropic aid could be further improved to ensure greater impact. Foundations and philanthropists should continue to provide assistance and support to the country's specific intervention programs in the most vulnerable countries. Foundations and other philanthropic organizations could also further contribute to reversing the underfunding in areas such as technology upgrading and innovation. The operationalization of the Secretary General's proposal for a technology bank that we are working on, especially for the least developed countries, also talked about technology transfer, innovation, adaptation, and diffusion, and that includes the area which is related to the medicines, vaccines, water verification, and treatment. We are working on that. We are looking forward to the feasibility study on that initiative. Once that is agreed, we do hope that that will also further contribute to enhance the access to health and, of course, sustainable development of all these countries. As we look towards the post-2015, as I said, we have all of us have to contribute in an integrated and holistic manner to make the transformational change that we are all looking for in ensuring sustainable development for all, bar none. It is with this collective effort of all that we could be able to reach these ambitious goals, and the health remains very much high on the priority of all the countries, but much more so for those who are like LDCs and other vulnerable countries. It is my hope that the ideas coming out of this conference will contribute to attaining our global development aspirations. I thank you for your kind attention, and I wish you a very productive deliberations. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Acharya. By the way, Mr. Acharya was the permanent representative of Nepal to the United Nations prior to his appointment as Under Secretary General. And since we are well synchronized, we have a former Swiss representative to Nepal, who is amongst our midst, Mr. Thomas Gass, who is the Assistant Secretary General for Policy and Interagency Affairs for the United Nations Department for Economic and Social Affairs. And I warmly welcome my dear friend Thomas. Thomas, welcome.
Thank you, Amir. That's how sometimes we get put back together. Ambassador Acharya was the one where to whom I presented my credentials when he was Secretary of Foreign Affairs. But I would like to say that it's distinguished ladies and gentlemen, it's a great privilege for me to be here with you this morning. Forums like this are very important, and I believe that we can all agree that governments cannot achieve everything on their own. And I think that is the theme of my little talk this morning. To address the challenges of development effectively, broad and effective partnerships are essential between governments and various forms of non-governmental organizations, including those that are philanthropic in nature, to assist in the formulation, in the implementation, in the monitoring and evaluation of development objectives and activities. This is not an easy task because we have different ways of functioning, we have different ways of coming to decisions. Governments tend to like the non-governmental world not to rock the boat too much and to communicate through the governmental channels. And so it requires creativity. And certainly within the UN Secretariat, the department that I represent, we are sometimes maybe somewhat the keepers of the Graal in terms of the intergovernmental process. But at the same time, we're very open and we are keen to hear how and to develop ways in which we can interact with the non-governmental sector, be it private sector, be it philanthropic and other, in order to make this process going forward meaningful, not just for us and for you, but for the beneficiaries and the world out there. As we know, member states, the UN system, and stakeholders worldwide are now fully engaged in consultations to define a post-2015 development agenda with poverty eradication and sustainable development at its core. And as we speak, as we are meeting here, there are other meetings that take place right now in another hall where the governments and also civil society are looking at this set of priority areas that hopefully will become the next set of sustainable development goals. The post-2015 development agenda is expected to be ambitious and transformative. We have a real opportunity to integrate the concerns for people and our planet. We have before us an opportunity to set in motion a rethink of development that is centered around inequality and poverty, concern for our planetary boundaries, social inclusion, and intergenerational equity. The post-2015 agenda can and should capture these shared problems within an integrated framework, one of achieving shared prosperity on a fragile and vulnerable planet. The Open Working Group that I just referred to, and which is elaborating the Sustainable Development Goals, has sought to tackle the root causes of environmental degradation. This includes issues such as unsustainable consumption and production patterns and use of natural resources. A fundamental change in lifestyles, beginning with the developed countries, is at the root of the changes that is needed. So this new agenda is not just an agenda for developing countries. It's not just an aid agenda. It's a universal agenda that is inviting us all to come on board. The Open Working Group is set on finding a path towards a more sustainable future in harmony with nature, even though framing these new issues into global and universal targets still remains a challenge, as you can imagine. Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, effective partnerships in the post-2015 era between different kinds of development partners will be key. The UN itself has been actively promoting partnerships, including with the private sector and including under the leadership of Mr. Dosal. The Economic and Social Council has, since 2008, convened an annual partnership forum, which has brought together senior private sector and foundation representatives to discuss with governments ways in which partnerships could be strengthened to support the MDGs. In 2009, this annual event engaged the private sector and considered ways in which partnerships could help promote global public health. Other UN system efforts include the Secretary General's partnership initiatives in the area of sustainable energy, education, and other critical to sustainable development. His Every Woman, Every Child and Zero Hunger initiatives have particular relevance to the issue of promoting the health and well-being of people worldwide. Now, the challenge of increasing inequalities, ladies and gentlemen, has received much prominence in recent months and over the last few years. And some of the consequences of inequalities and how it affects economic growth, even affects democracy, have come to the fore and are being discussed in a very interesting way over the last 2 years. Indeed, the concept of leaving no one behind has been strongly articulated in the Open Working Group on Sustainable Development Goals. It is clear that the new Sustainable Development Goals will aim to bring development to each and every citizen from all walks of life, and especially from marginalized groups. Taking a lesson from the MDG experience, it's also clear that it will not be enough to meet targets in the aggregate. Rather, the needs of the poorest and most vulnerable must be met. Thus, universal goals will aim to help the youth and the older, women and children, indigenous people, people with disabilities, migrant workers. And in order to do that, it will not work if we work in a top-down fashion with a goal that is established here in Turtle Bay, and then rolled down in a symmetric or systematic function through the countries. That will not work. It will take us the 15 years until everybody even knows about these new sustainable development goals. Therefore, it is our ambition, all those who are engaged in this, and I know that Amir is also part of those, to get everyone on the starting line by September 2015, so that when these goals are established, we can use them as a beacon in all countries, in all communities to start implementing. And we might not all start with the same goal or with the exact same approach, but the important thing is to move forward, to be ambitious, and to know that we want to change the way this planet is being used over the next 15 years. Distinguished ladies and gentlemen, while there has been enormous progress in health during the era of the MDGs, we know that many targets have not yet been reached. There's a strong international consensus, therefore, that the MDGs explicitly related to health, namely the fourth one, reduce child mortality, the fifth one, improve maternal health, and the sixth one, combat HIV/AIDS, malaria, and other diseases, should be integral to the post-2015 agenda. Moreover, non-communicable diseases, mental health, and injuries have become the dominant cause of morbidity and mortality globally. Non-communicable diseases are responsible for a rising burden of disease, even as these countries are still battling the diseases of poverty. It is worth noting that the current working document of the Open Working Group also endorses the achievement of universal health coverage, including financial risk protection, with particular attention to the most marginalized. It also calls for universal access to affordable essential medicines and vaccines for all. Ladies and gentlemen, in closing, we have before us an opportunity to inject ambition and transformative vision to bring about a bold post-2015 development agenda. In other words, we have before us the opportunity and potential to powerfully transform our common humanity. Thank you.
Thomas, thank you very much. And by the way, what Thomas mentioned about the dialogue with the private sector, it's currently, it's been ongoing, and we have the 11th Open Working Group meeting, which is where the Department of Economic and Social Affairs is monitoring this. And you might want to visit the website, sustainabledevelopment.un.org. And if you look at 11th Working Group there, you'll see sustainable agriculture and nutrition as one of the topics under the poverty alleviation agenda being discussed this morning. So, and you can actually contribute. There's a process in there where you can make submissions and put ideas to it. So it is a very inclusive process. So thank you, Thomas, for putting that on the map. I'd now like to invite my friend, Roland Rich, who is, as I mentioned, a democracy expert, a partnership expert, a long-standing foreign service officer from the Australian government, and the UN is privileged to have him on its side. Welcome, Roland. Thank you.
Thank you, Amir, and allow me, ladies and gentlemen, to add my welcome to that of my colleagues. Well, we are gathered here today largely because of Amir's unflagging enthusiasm. Amir has been one of the great champions of bringing together international public and private sectors for the benefit of the world's neediest, and today is just one example of Amir's contribution. I thought I'd start my little talk this morning with a piece of research I read over the weekend. You know, these days, to successfully advance the field in social science, it's important to find a new unmined data set. And this research found that data set in a musty archive in one of the British museums. It was the conscription records for the First World War. And when this data set was mined and when the researcher looked at the issues, he came to a remarkable conclusion. Europeans, over the last century, grew by 4 inches, 10 centimetres. The average height of the conscripts in the First World War was 5'6", 167 centimetres. Today, the average height of Europeans is 5'10", 177 centimetres. 4 inches in 100 years is remarkable. The obvious explanation for that growth, and we've seen a similar phenomenon in Japan, a well-documented phenomenon in Japan of growth over the last century. And the explanation that's often given is improved diet. But I won't go through all the details. This research found that diet does not fully explain this growth. Improved health explains this growth. It's because in that period, chronic intestinal parasites and chronic bronchial diseases were controlled, and that allowed children to reach their full potential. And I use those terms because this is a lot more than health. It's about full physical and intellectual potential, and that's what we need to work on. Not just health, we need to work on all aspects of development. So what can we do? Well, the UN has been active in the health field, and not without success. The UN and its member states have got some pretty remarkable achievements to talk about. The eradication of smallpox, one example. The development, dissemination, and the dissemination of the knowledge of simple oral rehydration solutions is another example of the UN saving millions of lives around the world with a piece of research and a piece of outreach to resolve problems of diarrheal diseases. But here's the bad news. I think, and I don't think I'm alone in this, I think the UN and its member states and the public sector has come to the end of what we can do by ourselves. I simply don't think that the problems that are presenting themselves today can be achieved simply by allowing the international public sector to deal with those problems. We need partnerships with the international private sector to also contribute to a solution to these problems. What sort of solution are we looking at? Last year, we held the Forbes Philanthropy Summit here at the UN. And here's what the Secretary General told the philanthropists at that summit. That the UN has the capacity, the knowledge, the ability to wipe out five diseases on Earth. We can control malaria, we can eradicate polio, we can pretty much control tetanus, eradicate measles, and we can eradicate HIV infections in newborns. We have the capacity, we know how this can be done. And what's more, the SG said it can be done in 5 years if we put the resources to it. When he mentioned those resources, he basically said it's the resources of the philanthropic sector that will make the difference. We can't expect the public sector, the international public sector, to grow much more than it has. We all know the problems of tax collection in every country in the world. We cannot expect that to be the new source of financing for this sort of a process. Let's have a look at some examples of what's been achieved. I think the towering figure in this field of philanthropic engagement in the international public space is Ted Turner. Ted Turner promised his $1 billion gift in 1998 to the UN and established the UN Foundation as a means to transfer that money. All that money has been transferred. What's more, we have now received at the UN $1.3 billion from the UN Foundation. And that remains an excellent entry point for anybody who wants to work with the UN. It's a 501c3 based in Washington with an office here in New York. That is a great way to enter the space if you're looking for a simple way of doing so. So Ted Turner really began this process. I think clearly Bill and Melinda Gates have had a tremendous contribution, and in particular on the issue of polio, where we were for a long time making tremendous progress to the point where only Afghanistan, Nigeria and Pakistan had endemic polio problems. Now, those governments are still cooperating with the UN efforts, but not all the people in those countries. And one of the great enemies here, the two greatest enemies are war and ignorance. And we're seeing the effect of those in, sadly, in Syria, where outbreaks of polio, which had been eradicated, have now returned. I think we should also mention Ray Chambers, another philanthropist who, to tell his story, one day he saw sleeping African children, but he was then told, no, they're not sleeping, they're in comas caused by malaria. And he decided that he could not do nothing. And he has mounted a tremendous campaign to disseminate impregnated malaria nets, and it's had its impact. We have now reduced the deaths from malaria in the last 7 years by 40%. So all this shows things can be done. We have the capacity to achieve all sorts of outcomes, but what we need is the cooperation of more than governments, more than public agencies. We need the cooperation of the private sector and the philanthropic sector. And ladies and gentlemen, that's where you come in. We very much encourage you to think about these issues, to look at your own situation, what you can do to contribute, and our doors are always open to discuss these issues with you. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you. Very good.
Roland, thank you very much. Roland's office serves as the gateway for partnerships and philanthropic action. I'm really pleased the way things have kind of grown exponentially under his leadership. I'd like to invite, and I hope you'll forgive me if I'm inelegant if I say this, I'd like to invite the last male speaker. And then you'll have forgive me, Gary, you'll have an inspirational young lady. Gary is a good friend. Gary Fowley is the director of the ITU office in New York. Gary and I go back many years at the time when he was within the United Nations, and he also served as the director for public affairs for the World Summit on Information Society. And then ITU did the smart thing. They grabbed him, and Gary is here to represent in his own capacity, and you'll be hearing him chair a wonderful panel this afternoon, but also has a message from Dr. Hamadoun Touré, the Secretary General of the International Telecommunication Union. Welcome, Gary.
Thank you very much, Amir. Thank you very much, Amir. Well, if you can't be inspirational, be controversial. I think that's the... And I'm not sure I can be inspirational, so I'm going to try and be maybe controversial. No, first of all, thank you very much for this invitation. Thank you for it's ITU's privilege, and we're very proud to be supporting this because ITU has a long history of working with the private sector, and I'll get to that so in a bit. But on behalf of Dr. Hamadoun Touré, who is the Secretary of General of the ITU, was not able to be here because our Governing Council meets starting today. It's like our Board of Directors meets today, and as you know, for the next 2 weeks, what the Board wants, the Board gets. So he's there, and he'll be meeting with them, and he sends his greetings and wishes you a very successful 2 days of 3 days of work, because healthcare and ICT, empowerment of people with healthcare and the improvement of their empowerment of people with information and communication technologies on one hand, and the improvement of their health go hand in hand. And I'll get to that in just a second as well. ITU is the UN agency for, a specialized agency for information communication technology. We've been in existence for almost 150 years next year. What makes us unique in one way is we're the only UN agency that have private sector members. We have 700, in addition to 190 three member states, we have 700 private sector members. And why is that? Well, ever since the beginning of the information age, which I would say began with the invention of the telegraph and was the beginning of the ITU, it has been a private-public partnership that has brought the benefits of information and communication technology to the world. One goes hand in the, with the other. We play a role in managing the satellite spectrum that, or satellite orbit space through treaty, the spectrum that empowers every one of the mobile phones that you have. We believe that to succeed in achieving our mission, which is to connect the world and to bring the benefits to all of the world, ICTs to all of the world's people, wherever they live and whatever their circumstances, we need to do that with you, you being a representative of the private sector and the foundations and the NGOs that enable it. First of all, I want to ask you, how many people here have at least one mobile phone? Put up your hands. 100%. How many of you have two? Exactly. How many of you have internet access? Everybody puts their... Well, despite what may this representative sample is, we're an anomaly. Yes, 90% of the world now does have access to mobile telephony, only about 65% in the developing world. The problem is internet access. We're still in the developing world, we're looking at 33 to 35% of the world that has access to the internet and the broadband-based networks that empower it. And that's really where the potential benefits are in the long run. Now, as colleagues here said, right now as we meet in the next building, the Open Working Group of Member States are meeting to try and decide what the vision will be post 2015 for the world. What are the aspirational goals that should be part of that? We've been trying very hard to get them to recognize that information and communication technology is a cross-cutting enabler of all three pillars of sustainable development. And those pillars are economic growth, social inclusion, and environmental balance. We know this because we know for every 10% penetration of broadband into an economy, that economy's GDP will grow by 1.8%. That's huge in GDP terms. But it's very difficult to get that recognition into a political action, and we call upon you for your help to do this. Fortunately, we do have the work of Undersecretary Acharya, his group. The least developed countries have been the drivers for equitable access. The least amongst us will lead the way, quite frankly, in this one. And I'm going to use my last, have I got 2 minutes more? Just to tell you how I came to that. In 1985, I was a reporter for The Economist. And this was my introduction to the ITU. I went to the ITU. They were dividing up the satellite spaces. The developed world wanted basically to prospect in space. They wanted all the satellite space. The least developed countries, who couldn't put a tin can into a two-foot orbit, saw the inequity, though. This was the future, information technology, satellites that deliver that. They demanded equitable access. The ITU, to its credit, looked at the problem, hired a diplomat by the name of Sir Donald Maitland, did a report called The Missing Link, and wouldn't you know, the missing link to economic development in many ways was access to telecommunications. ITU set a goal that by the year 2000, everybody would be within 5 miles walking distance to a telephone. Well, thanks to the revolutionary power of technology, we were well ahead of that. But it was the least developed countries that pushed ITU and its partners in the private sector to look seriously at this potential of this empowering technology. And I think they're going to do it again. In 2010, the least developed countries met in Istanbul United Nations Istanbul Plan of Action was the result of that meeting. That plan of action is very clear. It says ICTs, information communication technologies, should be recognized as basic infrastructure on par, basically, with water, transportation, and power. And they set a very challenging but probably realistic goal of having universal access to the internet by 2020. These are the least amongst us that are pushing for this. These are countries that are living, people that are living on less than $2 a day, that are prepared to put up a large proportion of the disposable income, up to 9-10% of it, to have access, because they know the power of it. They know that information enables them to empower themselves. It brings better health care. It brings access to it enables the e-health initiatives that we're going to hear about in the next 3 days. You're going to hear a lot of. But you have to have access to it. So if you agree with me, and I'm hoping you do, that ICTs are a cross-cutting enabler of economic and social and environmental empowerment, please help us get that message to the member states here at the United Nations, to colleagues, call, write letters, whatever you need to do, because we kind of missed this in the Millennium Development Goals. They didn't recognize the power of technology, and it turned out to be such a catalyst. And it's because I think, working with the private sector is not something that is entirely the easiest task here at the UN, but this is one area where we can put private sector, private-public partnerships into action for the betterment of development for all, healthcare specifically. One specific goal I think we need to talk about in the next few days is the fact that 35% of children born in the developing world do not have birth registration. We don't know who these kids are. Yet we've got 90% penetration in mobile technology. There's got to be a way to count these kids so that every woman counts, every child counts, and every child is counted. Mobile, that's just one example of how health, you know, that will have a huge impact on health care of these children and their mothers. So there's lots of things we can do together. You're working in the field. You're working. You have the history, the resources to bring together the disparate powers that will enable healthcare to fulfillment of healthcare and the potential of healthcare with mobile technology. We're looking for you for your input and your guidance. All the very best for the next 2 days. And if you have any questions over the next few days, please contact me. We'd love to engage you in our work. Thank you.
Thank you, Gary. I really appreciate how you put things in perspective and bring it down to reality. So Gary is also part of the initiative which Mr. Acharya is a member of, is the Broadband Commission for Digital Development, and I'm privileged to be one of the commissioners in that process. Now I am honored to introduce an internationally renowned health expert and endocrinologist, a geriatrician, which I'll be consulting you soon, actually, a women's health expert. She has 4 academic appointments, including with King's College London, Yale University. She has delivered and published over 600 lectures in that field of women's health. She's advisor to the White House. She's advisor to NASA, which is why we felt that the 1-to-4 ratio was much better. You only needed one woman to offset the 4 men on one left. And I am honored and delighted to welcome Dr. Sarah Lynn Mark. Welcome.
Distinguished guests, colleagues, friends, good morning. It is an honor and a pleasure to join you this week and to have the opportunity to talk to you this morning about sex in space. Yes, I did say sex in space, the ultimate in universal healthcare. What I know is going through your minds right now would be a fascinating discussion, and perhaps we can have that tonight over a lot of wine during the reception. But what I want to talk to you is about something that is going to be the cornerstone for healthcare. The cornerstone, the very building blocks for precision health or personalized medicine. I hope it will begin to shape the way you see the panel discussions over the next few days. It will change the way that you think about science and research and your own healthcare. And that is sex and gender-based medicine. When I use the term sex, I'm really looking at it from the Institute of Medicine perspective. It's how one connotes oneself as male or female at the most basic biological level. When I talk about gender, I'm talking about the psychosocial constructs which deems one male or female. Now, I know that my time by the agenda is basically up, so I will have to speak pretty much at warp speed to take you on this journey. Now, you may be asking, why have I woven sex and space together? As an endocrinologist and a geriatrician, space is the ultimate frontier to study accelerated aging. As your body adapts to the microgravity environment of space, it changes, and it changes rather quickly. It is an ideal, perfect environment to begin studying how men and women adapt to that environment, to really begin to understand sex and gender-based medicine very quickly and very dramatically. So what I will do over the next few minutes and at warp speed is take you on that journey and share with you several areas that are of importance to you for your health, not only in space, but also on Earth. Now, as I look out into the room, I see several of you who may actually be candidates to be astronauts for Sir Richard Branson's journey on Virgin Galactic. I'm happy to say Dennis Tito is exploring the issues of sending a couple over the age of 50 to Mars in 2021. It's only a 589-day mission. And you do have to take your spouse, not someone else's. So these issues are really critical. And they're critical to all of us because as we're sitting here, we're aging. And we need to understand this. Over the past year, I had the pleasure of having over 60 scientists from around the country in Canada come together and explore sex and gender-based medicine in the issue of how NASA needs to work health issues for space, long-duration space travel. So let me touch upon a couple of key areas that will impact you on your life on Earth. One of the most important areas is cardiovascular health. In the United States, it is the leading killer for both men and women. What most people don't realize is that women often present with symptoms that are a bit different. And what they also don't realize is the conventional technology that we have to diagnose heart disease in women does not work. Women may present with what we consider microvascular disease. So the traditional angiography may actually miss the disease in women. We have a saying in healthcare that men explode, women erode. And what I'm talking about is what happens to the coronary arteries when plaque develops. So we do need to develop innovative technologies. And this isn't just an issue to the Western world. We're beginning to see accelerated cardiovascular disease in nations all across the globe, partially because of lifestyle factors, partially because we are living longer. And so we do need to understand this. Now, for women and men in space, some fascinating changes happen. When you go into space, you have what's called cephalic distribution of fluid. Basically, what that means is blood flows from your legs to your brain. So you may notice some of our astronauts have what we consider a moon facies, a little puffier. I've often been asked, does cellulite and wrinkles get better in space? The answer is yes. Unfortunately, as soon as you come back to terra firma and gravity, that does not continue. But what we see in space is that the heart assumes a spherical shape. It doesn't have to work as hard because, again, everything is flowing up to your brain. What is fascinating is as our astronauts return to Earth, we see sex differences. Almost 100% of our female astronauts begin to experience what we consider orthostatic hypotension. Basically, they feel dizzy and some have actually fainted. So we do need to understand why. And possibly, it may be, we know that as women respond to stress, heart rate increases, but men, when they respond to cardiovascular stress, they vasoconstrict, they clamp down. And it may be due to the hormonal milieu, such as estrogen causing vasodilation, testosterone causing constriction. Another important area is osteoporosis. And I hope it's a disease state that we all understand what it is. It's a state of low bone mass, low bone density, and microarchitectural deterioration. So that even if you just fell off your chair, you could potentially fracture a bone. It's becoming a worldwide pandemic. It's an issue that we all need to be concerned about. As we're sitting here in this room, we are all losing about 1% of our bone mass per year. For some of us going through menopause, that accelerates to 3 to 5% for the first few years. Now, I said years here. When you go into space, you lose about 3 to 5% of your bone mass per month. Per month. So some of you who are going to take that trip to Mars, imagine what your bones will look like. What is fascinating is that osteoporosis and fractures affect women 4 times more than men. 4 times more. But what most people don't realize is that if a man has an osteoporotic fracture, such as a hip fracture, he is more likely to die in the first year compared to a woman. I'd like to ask all of you, for the men in this room, have any of your physicians ever asked you about your bone health, about your calcium intake, about resistance exercise, about how smoking impacts your bones? And perhaps the answer to that is no. So this is a very serious issue, one that we're looking at very closely. Another important area is immunological changes. Now, as we get older, we develop something called bone marrow suppression. That's why you probably heard when we were dealing with H1N1 and other flu issues that we're concerned about our very young and we're concerned about our older generations because they cannot mount effective responses. What we saw with H1N1 was that women tended to be more resistant to infection. But once they were infected, they mounted very robust responses. In fact, some even began attacking their own cells. We call that cytokine storm. We know there are significant sex differences with immunological diseases. For example, over 70% of the autoimmune diseases that we face are more common in women. We also know the hormonal cycles certainly have an impact. And for some diseases, pregnancy protects or improves, and in others, it worsens it. In space, we're concerned because you have bone marrow suppression. Again, that system of being aged, accelerated aging. So we're very worried about relapses of infection or recurrences of cancer, something that we spend a great deal of time thinking about. And I know this is something that all of us need to think about on this planet as well, to really look at sex differences when you think about vaccines and antimicrobials. Another important area is the area of neurovestibular changes. Let me ask you a very short question. Do you think men and women think differently? That's probably about the only thing we'll ever really totally agree on, and the answer to that is you're right. And part of the reason is our brains are wired differently. Sally Shaywitz did some very innovative research looking at the brains of men and women using PET scans and found that the corpus callosum, that little highway in the brain connecting the right and the left hemispheres, very, very active in women, not so much in men. It seems that women will use both hemispheres. Men tend to use one side. And when I say this, when I talk about sex and gender differences, I'm not talking about ways for us to discriminate and to say who is smarter or faster or better. That's not it. It's that we are wired differently and we need to be attuned to this. So what is the clinical implication? What we see for individuals who've had a stroke, especially younger women, they may regain the use of their speech a little faster, a little more efficiently. NASA is very concerned about the brain because we're experiencing a condition called visual impairment intracranial pressure, VIP. And what is happening is we're seeing in our astronauts when they go into space, whether it's short-term or long-duration missions, which right now to this date it's 6 months, they're developing a condition where there's increased pressure in the brain and there is actually visual impairment. What is absolutely fascinating is that women may show some signs of it on a scan, but it is men who are clinically impaired by this. So we do need to understand it. What is fascinating, we talked about Alzheimer's last night. Of the 5.1 million individuals afflicted, over two-thirds are women. When we talk about cancer, for example, lung cancer, three times women are more likely to develop cancer, lung cancer, if they're a non-smoker compared to their male counterparts. So we do need to begin to understand these differences. And finally, a very important area is the area of behavioral health. Now, we often talk about the fragile Y syndrome, men's chromosome, which doesn't have as many genes as a woman's. Well, the clinical implications is that in utero, the male offspring is at risk. We see, for example, in the world of epigenetics, that if a mother is stressed, her male offspring may be at higher risk for developing mental health issues. So we know behavioral health is extremely important in the world of sex and gender-based medicine. We also know that women are 2 times more likely to be diagnosed with affective disorders, but unfortunately only a quarter are properly diagnosed, and a quarter of that group are appropriately treated. Now, if you're going to go to the moon or to Mars, you have to get along with your colleagues, and especially our international groups. You can't vote someone off the island. You can't throw them off the vehicle. You can't kill them. Not a successful mission. So we do need to understand behavioral differences in gender communication. It's extremely, extremely important. NASA developed a whole slew of recommendations, including ensuring that we properly educate our clinicians, that we ensure research is provided. The National Institutes of Health in the United States has something called the NIH Revitalization Act, which was passed in 1993, that mandates women and minorities be included in phase 3 trials. In the U.S., the FDA is looking at new laws to ensure that drug device companies, that medical device companies and pharmaceutical companies are ensuring that women are included in these trials and we can begin to assess. I'm sure every one of us in this room has taken aspirin at one time or another. What most people realize is that the impact of aspirin is very different in men and women. We see that women may have protection against strokes, but men may not. We see that women will only really get that protection against cardiovascular disease if they're there over the age of 65, whereas for men it tends to be a bit younger. And it will be younger for women if they have significant risk factors for heart disease. So you can see this is an important area. In fact, in the last decade, 8 out of 10 drugs had to be pulled off the market because they were more toxic in women. Think about it. When you pick up an over-the-counter agent or a pharmaceutical, think about it. Has it been tested in somebody that looks like you? Well, NASA, as I mentioned, is developing a lot of recommendations. Again, proper research, proper equipment to teach our clinicians and our scientists. And it really is for all of us here on Earth as well to do that. And we need to do that to ensure better health and better health care for men and women. So in closing, I think it's most appropriate, since we're at the United Nations, to quote one of our former Secretaries of State, Henry Kissinger, when he said, "There will be no winning of the battle of the sexes. There is just too much fraternizing with the enemy." So with that thought, I wish all of you stellar health and, of course, to have stellar medicine. Thank you.
Thank you. Very good. Thank you very much.
So now you know the term, beam me up, Scotty. Sarah Lynn will take care of us. Thank you so much for that inspiring remark, Sashree. Really appreciate that. That brings us to the end of our opening plenary. I want to mention to you that for lunch, after the session's over, we will meet in the delegates' dining room. You'll have our team of volunteers who will direct you. Just to give you an idea, I think we might go from this side. It's actually along the East River. There'll be somebody directing you. Through the passageways, through the scaffolding above you, to the elevator, which will take you to the fourth floor. And then we'll reconvene back in this room after the lunch. And then, by the way, the gala dinner is also in the delegates' dining room. I am now delighted to hand over the proceedings to our next chairman, a wonderful human being, Peter Samuelson, who is a super accomplished producer. He is actually a serial entrepreneur. He has produced 25 films in 25 years. And in between, he has created a number of foundations and charities to help others. He's focused on children's charities, chronic illnesses. Then there is another one called EDAR, which is about putting a roof on people's heads. It's remarkable. The Starlight Foundation is probably what you know about. But the Starbright Foundation, he founded with General Norman Schwarzkopf and Steven Spielberg. It's really about how to bring happiness to people. And we're so honored to have you here, sir. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you. And I'd like to ask my panelists if they would come up and... It's a little strange because there are five of you, so we'll have to divide up between the two sides. While that's happening, two little bits of housekeeping. First of all, I've been asked to tell you that when we get to the Q&A, if you notice in front of you there is a piece of electronic machinery that looks like a transistor radio that you had in the 1980s. On it, there is an oblong button. You have to press that down while you are speaking. I'd also like to say that you have carefully selected which nation-state sign you are seated behind. So when I call upon you, if you would please, in the native language of that sign, give a 2 to 4 minute, 20-year epidemiological history of that nation. We'll begin with that. So welcome. Welcome. And we even have signs, I think. Dr. Jonathan, we have signs of... Oh, perfect. Thank you. I think we even have speaker signs that are going to go in front of the speakers so that we will know who the speakers are. So I think almost everybody in this room, certainly those who are awake on a Monday morning, will have realized that the world is quite broken in in many ways, not just in the health challenges that face us, but the clean water challenges, the climate change challenges, the tribalism challenges, the social justice challenges, and many other challenges. So the question is what to do. We have 75 minutes here, and our goal is to entirely solve all of those issues. And if there is time left over, we will move over to peace in the Middle East and in other global hotspots. I'm going to introduce our speakers. We have Josh Cohen, who is right there. Hello, Josh. Welcome. Josh is the co-founder and managing director of CityLight Capital, which invests in companies tackling society's toughest challenges. Josh sits on the boards of License Stream and CityLight Carbon, and he is an observer to the boards of Tutor and ShotSpotter. He was formerly an observer to the board of Oxio, and before it was acquired by JCI Group. Josh had previous venture capital experience through a family office in St. Louis and the SV Group, a private debt fund. I'm also very honored to introduce Kay Koplowitz. Kay is right there. Kay is a founder of USA Network and the Sci-Fi Channel. She created the business model for cable television networks when she launched the first national basic cable network in 1977, clearly as a child. She was the first woman president in television history and a visionary for what she grew into a multi-billion dollar business. She's the chairman and co-founder of Springboard Enterprises, a global accelerator of women-led businesses in technology and the life sciences. And she's the co-founder of Boldcap Ventures, an early stage investor in media, technology, and biotech. So welcome. Also with us, we have Liesl Pritzker-Simmons, who is the co-founder and principal of Blue Haven Initiative, which is a single-family office that invests for profit and non-profit capital to solve social problems. BHI looks across asset classes and capital types to find solutions-oriented opportunities, both in the U.S. and in the developing markets. Liesl is also co-founder of the IDP Foundation, which mobilizes resources and strategic support to increase educational opportunities. The IDP Foundation has supported and developed a wide range of programs, including the innovative IDP Rising Schools program in Ghana, which leverages microfinance networks to empower nearly 300 low-cost private schools with trainings and financial services. Liesl is also co-founder of Opportunity International's Young Ambassadors for Opportunity, a global network of young professionals who are passionate about microfinance. She serves on the boards of Waste Enterprises, EcoPost, Impact Assets, and Synergos. We also have with us Greg Simon, who is right there. Hello, Greg. Sorry, can't see the signs. Greg is Chief Executive Officer of Polywog. He has held senior positions in both houses of Congress and the White House, has been a senior executive at Pfizer and led Foster Cures and the Center for Accelerating Medical Solutions, a national patient advocacy nonprofit. And last but certainly not least, Brian Trelstad is Managing Director of Bridges Ventures, a specialist fund manager that uses an impact-driven approach to create superior returns for investors and society at large. Brian has over 10 years' experience in impact investing. He served until 2012 as the chief investment officer of the Acumen Fund, overseeing investments in companies delivering health, water, energy, and agricultural services to the base of the economic pyramid in South Asia and Sub-Saharan Africa. And I'm Peter Samuelson. I am or was a film producer. What you learn as a film producer is to repetitively do entrepreneurial things. Every year you're on to another project. And what I have transferred sideways over the last 2.5, 3 decades is that entrepreneurial skill set to nonprofit pro-social causes. I had the great honor to found the Starlight Children's Foundation 30 years ago, And indeed, we have raised $1 billion and spent it, I might say, with 52 offices around the world, providing psychosocial services to seriously ill kids and their mums and dads and their siblings. Steven Spielberg and I co-founded Starbright World as an online network, a playground, if you like, for seriously ill teenagers unable to get out of a hospital bed, using what was then the very early technology of the internet to link them together with distractive entertainment, educational, and just playing community. It's never been turned off. It's moderated from Los Angeles and from Australia when Los Angeles goes to bed. I founded the advocacy organization First Star to lobby on behalf of foster youth in the United States, and then EDAR, which houses the homeless, and most recently Aspire, which is the Academy for Social Purpose in Responsible Entertainment, where we are teaching pro-social media skills, not in the film school, but across all the other departments of universities, starting with UCLA, which is the pilot site. So I'm going to make a little opening statement, and then I'm going to ask each of the panelists to make their five-minute opening statement. I'd like to say something about the Medici. The Medici were the Italian family that really jump-started the Renaissance. And the Renaissance was one of the great flowerings of human intelligence, discovery, and accomplishment. And I'd just like us to perhaps give some credit to the Medici, and I think they are very much relevant, because I'm acutely aware that sitting in this room behind the signs of some very challenged third world countries are some of the most powerful people in the first world, people who are self-determinant, who run family offices, who are in a position to deploy capital to support one kind of pro-social idea or another. And my view is, if we look at the Medici, we can perhaps gain some clues as to what might be the most productive way to make the world a better place if one is fortunate enough to have been put in a self-determinant position of deploying capital. The Medici, first of all, no one explained to them that they should be siloed. So they did everything. They were interested in everything, and they were so powerful that no one was in a position to tell them, well, sorry, we don't educate people in the arts and the sciences. We only do one or the other. So they never specialized. They were interested in fine art, but they were also interested in science. Also, nobody ever told them that experts must only be hired from expert places, so they encouraged the tutor of their children that they had hired to teach their kids math, and he was a fine chap called Galileo, and it was by studying one of their chandeliers that he made some discoveries that got him in an awful lot of trouble, because he extrapolated that perhaps the sun did not pass around the earth, but vice versa, and that gravity pulled things towards the center of the earth. They also backed one of the great multilateral thinkers in the history of the world. They were able to encourage great explorations, for example, of the United States, which wasn't the United States then, but they were the financiers of great explorations. Leonardo da Vinci, a man of many facets, was one of their acolytes. So what can we perhaps learn from the Medici all those years ago? And where are they now? I think they are all around. I think we are blessed to have self-determinant families in various parts of the world, and certainly in North America, who are actually disproportionately interested in applying their wisdom, their capital, their resources, their thinking, their encouragement to making the world a better place, and they do that. And I would modestly suggest that those groups, whether they are investing for profit, or they are investing pro-socially through philanthropic methods, and one is not necessarily better than the other. They do have the ability to encourage multilateral thinking, to bring together disparate people. I will never forget when Steven Spielberg and I started putting meetings together in a great medical center in Los Angeles at UCLA, but we were bringing producers, directors, writers, actors. We were bringing technologists and software writers and so forth. And everybody was very, very excited that, you know, here were these people. There were doctors saying, I've never met a film director before. I've never met one of these actors before. And we were collaborating on something that was multidisciplinary. But then there would also be doctors. There would be an oncologist sitting in rapt conversation with an epidemiologist. And then they would come up at the end and say to Stephen or to me, so grateful that you've introduced us. I don't think we would ever have met. And we would say, but don't you work in the same building? Well, yes, but, you know, because of the enormous amount of medical knowledge in the world, we've had to go narrow in order to go deep. And we're very grateful for these opportunities. I don't think the problems in the world are siloed. I think they're all interrelated. And you need to have about 100 different expertises to crack any of them. So one of the great opportunities of capital and of our great families and of our investors is to have an impact by driving towards innovation, trying the new, encouraging people to think outside the box. So I'm going to, if I may, turn to Kay first and ask if you would make your opening statement.
Certainly.
Thank you.
May I do it up there? If I
yes,
can
absolutely. Please do.
Thank you, Peter, for the opportunity to join your panel today. And thank you, Amir, for organizing this conference, you and your colleagues. It's a delighted to be here with you today. Listening to the panelists so far, I realize that there's a confluence of lots of things that we all believe in. I think we believe in the power of knowledge, in being able to share it, the power of partnerships, of public and private partnerships. And I want to talk just a few minutes about some of the things that I have seen and I'm involved in that I think really meet these criteria. The first is HealthPhone. HealthPhone was founded by one of my colleagues, Nan Wadhwani, who saw the desperate need for health information for women in India who have given birth to children and having a very high death rate of those children. And he said, someone has to do something about this. So 13 years ago, he quit his job, and he started producing videos in different Indian languages directed at women in pre- and postnatal, and the child in the first 100 years would be appropriate, 1,000 days of birth. He wanted to see what kind of impact he could have on this marketplace in really informing women about the best practices in healthcare for themselves and for their newborns. And he produced these videos that could be on a cell phone, a very simple feature cell phone. And if they weren't connected, and they cannot be connected for video for the most part, yet to the internet, he put them on SD cards, and the SD cards were inserted in these phones. And he did the pilot a year ago in the Maharashtra district outside of Mumbai. It was so successful with women who wanted to know, women who did not have access. They are outside the grid. In the ITO, Gary, we have to speak. They are outside the grid of connection. And here was the first time that they really could be connected to video explaining simple health care to them in their native language and oftentimes their local dialect. It was an amazing pilot program. It was so successful that the Minister of Health said, we in the Maharashtra district said, we are going to make this available to every woman giving birth in our district. And this is going to have a major impact today. HealthPhone is a vast personal video library today that is going to be made available to Indian women, hopefully throughout the country, but starting in this area where Vodafone has now stepped up and said that they are going to advertise on their advertisements the health phone availability, make it available at no cost to the user, to those that can access the internet or cell phones that can download video, and the people who are outside that interconnected universe are going to have this available on SD cards that Vodafone is going to make available in the 500,000 shops around the district where they deliver so they can be bought for very low cost. This is a remarkable advancement. If I were to ask Nan today what is his idea, what is his ideal, what is his vision would be that every woman giving birth in the world would have access to this information. And with the technology available today in communication, we can make this available in any language on video that is easily understandable by people who are both literate and illiterate. This is the basis of another advancement to advanced communications to the 21st century. It's how I got into this in the first place, into knowing Nan and our colleagues at Video for Villages. Video for Villages is really taking this concept of being able to bring this video information to people who are not yet connected to the internet, but can have the information on SD cards inserted in very simple feature phones, which are the phones used by the majority of the population throughout the developing world. And we can connect them. I think to myself, being a communications person, a visual person from the television business, I know what the impact can be for people. And I think about them and think about moving from the 15th century to the 21st century communications in first simple steps and will ultimately be connected. So this is very important, I think, to realize that this is a confluence of philanthropy, because HealthPhone is a nonprofit, of corporations, Vodafone, which are coming together, and public policy that is really pushing this information to the forefront. So I think it's really the confluence for what we are hoping to establish in the proclamations for 2015. But let me say, I've seen a lot of women in this area as well. And 15 years ago, we started an organization, my colleagues and I started an organization called Springboard Enterprises to identify women who are in technology and life sciences. And thank you, Sherilyn, for bringing to fore the difference on how women and men think, because this is probably the basis of what we found when we went out to look for women in these fields of life sciences. One of them is here with me today. Heather Potters is sitting here in the front row. I hope you get a chance to meet her. She is a co-founder with Kathleen Collender of PharmaJet, a needleless injector for vaccines. This is being distributed today. It's been a long road, but it has been distributed today in more than a dozen countries around the world, reducing diseases spread by reuse of needles, which is a very important reason why they founded this company, but also reducing the amount of vaccine that has to be used in order to be effective, saving lives and reducing cost. I'd like to speak a lot more about that initiative and others that the women we have, over 550 of them that we've brought to market so far in the last 15 years, like the woman who is producing generic drugs in Africa for HIV and malaria vaccines. So I think there are just enormously wonderful stories that we can bring to bear. But let me just say, I'm a very strong proponent of combining public, private, philanthropic, and sustainable businesses that have the revenue to sustain them over time and really solve a lot of our healthcare problems. Thank you.
Our next speaker is Brian Trelstad, who is going to do his 5-minute opening statement. Please.
Thank you, Peter. Good morning. It's a privilege to be here. I want to start with a story of a company that we invested in that tried to tackle one of the large Millennium Development Goals. Now, elimination of HIV transmission is a huge problem, and the UN, among others, the World Bank, the Global Fund, have made that an explicit objective in sub-Saharan Africa. There was one problem. Particularly in ending transmission from men, there aren't enough physicians and nurses on the continent to circumcise all the men who need to be circumcised to achieve the Millennium Development Goal. An Israeli entrepreneur developed a small device called the Prepex, which allows for non-surgical male circumcision. And with support from the Gates Foundation and my prior fund, the Acumen Fund, was looking to get the World Health Organization's approval to scale up this device. Distribution of the device, they had a partnership with the Ministry of Health in Rwanda. The pace of the decision-making of the global health community to get this device approved to an entrepreneur was mind-bending. But they persisted, and just this last quarter, the device was given WHO approval, and now 200,000 of them are on order for Rwanda and the beginning of a scale-up, which we hope will help achieve the Millennium Development Goal. Fast forward to the United Kingdom, where I now work for a fund called Bridges Ventures, a $550 million fund, which is aiming to invest in businesses that are located or serve underserved communities in developed countries. Same challenges of obesity, diabetes, lack of fitness opportunities in low-income communities that exist here in the United States as exist in the United Kingdom. But 8 years ago, the fund spotted the opportunity to develop affordable gym chains, not high-end gym chains like Equinox that cost 60, 70, 80 pounds per month, but those that would be open 24/7, that would be located in poor, low-income communities, that would be available to shift workers. They reverse-engineered all the costs out of the gym. They got rid of the sauna. They made membership available online and have launched a gym chain that's available and affordable to low-income folks for 15 pounds per month. It's now the fastest-growing health and fitness company in the country. Both of these companies and both of the funds are examples of an emerging trend of impact investing that I've had the privilege to be part of. Entrepreneurs are not daunted by the challenges of global public health. They're excited by them, but they're very impatient and at times undiplomatic. So the challenge, I think, for global public health, global institutions like the UN, is how to spot those who have the potential, who have real insight, and to work with them and their impatience and channel that into productive company-building, scalable opportunities. At Acumen Fund, we were a spin-out of the Rockefeller Foundation, and over the decade that I was there, we invested roughly $100 million into high-growth companies that manufactured anti-malarial bed nets, developed the first private sector ambulance service in India, had a maternal hospital chain based in Hyderabad that had high-quality, uncompromising quality and integrity to provide services for mothers who were used to giving birth to children at home. Now at Bridges Ventures in the UK and in the US, where we're raising a fund, we're looking at opportunities to think about affordable, quality health care, creating jobs in a growing sector of the economy, providing home health care services for our loved ones, early autism to intervention, et cetera, et cetera. And the common themes from both Acumen Fund, which was a philanthropically funded impact investment fund, and Bridges Ventures, which is a purely commercial investment fund, is to identify those entrepreneurs who do have a compelling business proposition and who are looking for aligned capital. One of the most important challenges is to help the entrepreneurs understand and navigate the public-private partnerships from a position of impetuousness and startup mentality. And there are institutions like Bridges and Acumen Fund, CityLight, and others that are an emerging part of an impact investing field, both in developed and developing economies, that were are going to be an important part of this conversation over the next decade, and I'm eager to share more about what we do with the Q&A over the coming hour.
Oops. Our next five-minute opening statement is from Liesl Pritzker-Simmons.
Hi. I wanted to start, actually, and just share a little bit about my personal story and why I think that family offices particularly are really well suited to make really innovative investments in healthcare and in other very impactful sectors. I'm a principal of our single family office, which is called Blue Haven Initiative. I inherited my wealth when I was 21 and sort of decided that I wanted to use that wealth, steward it properly, and think about how I can make positive change in the world. And so after volunteering in a couple of places in the developing world, I did sort of what you're supposed to do when you have wealth and you want to make change in the world. You set up a foundation. So I did that. I spent a lot of times actually in these halls here learning about large health problems, education problems. And we focused our philanthropic activities to address a number of those, particularly around education in the developing world. But one of the things you hear a lot when you go to philanthropic conferences is you really want to find scalable, market-based solutions. Those are buzzwords when you're talking to philanthropists these days. Data-driven, we have to have our metrics right. And I realized very quickly as I was missing all of my investment committee meetings because I was busy at these philanthropic conferences or I was over in Ghana or over in Tanzania, that actually I really wasn't using the right form of capital if market-based solutions and scalable solutions are what we're looking for. And I also wasn't using enough of them. I was using 5% of the 10% of all of the assets that I had available to me to steward. And so a number of years ago, with a lot of help from a lot of people, we decided to reorganize the whole way that our family office thinks about investments. And basically, how do we start from what's the impact that we want to see, what's the problem that we're trying to solve, and what's the right type of capital and the right investment structure to see that problem through to the end of the sentence. And what we decided to focus on was an approach across different asset classes. And we include philanthropic assets in that as well. And over the past few years, I've run into a few family offices, and hopefully there are more in this room that I haven't met yet, that take this approach. Instead of looking at each investment as it comes to you, how do you think about what your investments are doing and how they interplay perhaps with the family's philanthropic goals? If a principal of your family office is spending a lot of time on education initiatives, do you have any education technology companies in your portfolio that might help them address those problems and help to find innovative solutions? The same thing in healthcare. Actually, healthcare is a really wonderful example of where there's a wonderful crossover between very good financial returns, if things are invested in the right way, and very impactful and scalable solutions. And how do you look across all of the investment portfolio and integrate those things together to have the maximum impact? We believe at Blue Haven Initiative that every investment that you make has an impact. And it's a question of measuring the positive impact, measuring the negative impact, and taking steps to maximize the positive impact and mitigate the negative impact. I don't want my grandchildren to have to pay for problems that I didn't price into my investments today. And so thinking with that long-term time horizon and thinking holistically across capital types, and that includes intellectual capital and human capital too, right? You know, a lot of people that are in the family office space are very interactive with their senators and congresspeople and people that can help make decisions on how to get better health care to more people faster. It's an incredibly important form of capital to leverage if you care about change in the healthcare sector. And so we try to think really strategically across all those different forms of resources to make those investments. And I'll tell you a little bit more about some of the specific ways we're doing that during the Q&A. Thanks.
Can I call on Greg Simon to make his 5-minute opening statement?
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me today. It was very interesting, the speeches that happened earlier today, because in my government time, I worked extensively on national and international telecommunications policy and also on space policy. And at the time I was doing that, I had no idea that I'd be doing what I'm doing today, probably because it wasn't possible, and until recently, it wasn't legal. More about that later in the morning. But let me go right to one point that I think is critical about health and innovation. All of the major innovations that we are now benefiting from in communications in particular started because of health. Samuel Morse was a portrait artist when his wife died of complications from childbirth, and it took the news a week to reach him because he was 500 miles away. He was writing her letters the entire time, and by the time he knew the news, she was already buried. So he took a cruise, and on the cruise, he attended a lecture about electromagnetic energy and came up with the idea for the telegraph so that people could communicate news and avoid a lot of human suffering that comes about from delay in important things in our lives. The fact that the United States government refused to buy the telegraph from him and instead insisted it be a private enterprise is the reason the United States is one of the only countries in the world that had a privately developed telecom structure instead of a government-owned one, something which causes a lot of interesting conversations at the ITU. When Alexander Graham Bell was working on a hearing aid, his best friend was Helen Keller, he accidentally invented the telephone, which was ironic because it disenfranchised the deaf for generations until we came up with technology to let the deaf use the telephone. When Vint Cerf developed the TCP/IP protocol for the internet, it was because his wife is deaf and he is almost deaf, and he got tired of guessing who was on the phone. So he wanted to have a visual way to communicate, and so he came up with a way to connect two computers with a little bit of code. And now if I tried to graph for you the internet, it would take this entire room. So health has been at the core of all innovations, and now it's time for health to be at the core of financial innovation. I was in California, and I was driving on the freeway, which is a redundant sentence, and I heard a song that I've heard 1,000 times. I used to be a musician. I've played it 1,000 times. And it finally occurred to me this was pretty much the message for our time. And the song was a song by Kenny Loggins, and the line was, "What a fool knows he sees. A wise man has the power to reason away." That is what's going on today in finance. Because of three things that are converging today, everything you know about capital formation and the investment community is changing. The three things are demographics. 10,000 people a day are turning 35. And 10,000 people a day are turning 65. If you look at everybody who's turned 65 since 1776 in America, half of them are alive today. The number of people over 80 will quadruple in the next 20 years, and the number of people over 65 will double. No one has ever lived in such a society. The second thing that's happening is the evolution of social media and online investing that connects everybody all the time and lets money move very quickly from one person's mind to another. And the third thing is a change in the law that now allows the crowd to invest in whatever they'd like to in both private and public markets in new ways. I give a longer talk, which I won't give you now, on the evolution of wealth as a proxy for wisdom. In our democracy, we used to think you had to own property to be allowed to vote or hold office. We finally gave that up, and after many years of struggles, the Civil War, the women's suffragette movement, we now allow everybody over the age of 18 to have a voice in who governs the country. But in finance, we still consider wealth a proxy for wisdom. And for years, millions of people's money has been aggregated and given to a few people for those few people to make the decisions on where they should go. Well, there are millions of people who are prepared to invest thousands of dollars in the future of health, and they're a lot easier to find than the few billions, than the few billionaires who have millions to invest in health. I've met a lot of billionaires who have a health issue, and no one is more motivated than a billionaire with a health issue. But the people who merely have thousands of dollars have just as many issues and just as much motivation to change the world. And now, through the three changes I mentioned, we can start letting the crowd invest in the future of health, and that is going to change everything, and I think for the better. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Greg. As a proud Los Angelino, I must point out and correct one thing, which is that we are investing billions of dollars right now to make our freeways much wider so that more people will be able to sit stationary on them in the future. I'm very happy to ask Josh Cohen to make his opening five-minute statement, please.
Morning. First, I'd like to thank the great folks at Cavendish Global, the New York Academy of Sciences, for having us here this morning. And Peter, I'd like to thank you for not having me follow the pitch on the circumcision technology. It made me a little uncomfortable. I'd like to share something about myself before I get started. The first is I'm incredibly impatient. So the notion of working in something that I don't care about until I'm 70 or 80 years old, and then relying on the last 10 years of my life to affect changes that I deeply care about today, isn't going to happen. And as soon as I realized that, I started a firm called City Light Capital 10 years ago. The second thing I'd like to share is that all I care about in this world is one thing, and that one thing is being a good dad. I care very, very deeply about the air my children will breathe, the safety of the playgrounds that they will play in, their ability to learn and thrive in a global world, and of course about their health. It was these things and my ability to build a great team that allowed us to structure City Light Capital and partner with great entrepreneurs using technology to make the world safer, smarter, and more sustainable. So let me tell you what I mean by that. In safety, we do three things. We invest in technologies that protect people, property, and places. Technologies like ShotSpotter. ShotSpotter is in the business of acoustic-based gunshot detection. Let it settle in. Literally, we put a series of network microphones that listen for the muzzle blast of a gun. Bang! Gun is fired. The sensors hear that sound and triangulate. And we could dispatch a police officer to the exact location where a gun is fired seconds after the gun goes off. Now, why that is important is less than 20% of gunshots are called in inner cities around the globe. We hear them roughly 100% of the time. In areas where this technology has been deployed for over a year, gunshot-related crime is down on average 35%. We found people still in the act of shooting. We found shell casings we could use as evidence. We found people bleeding to death that we could take to hospitals. We also invest in education. Within education, we're focused on technologies that reduce the dropout rate, increase access, affordability, and performance of learners. Companies like StraighterLine. You today can go on StraighterLine.com and for $99 a month, you could take college-level courses and transfer to hundreds of universities, which will give you college credit for those courses, literally completing your entire freshman year pursuing a degree for less than $1,000. And finally, we invest in the environmental sector. For us, that's energy efficiency, waste and water management, and carbon reduction. In addition to these sectors of investment, we are prone to building businesses. And this one's a secret. We have not announced this publicly, but I could tell looking at this crowd that I'm amongst friends, so I'll share. We are about to launch a company called HeroX. You can go on herox.com today. It is a joint venture between City Light Capital and the XPRIZE Foundation. Just by show of hands, people know the XPRIZE Foundation? Great, so I'll skip that part. What we've done is we've taken the intellectual property and the best practices of the XPRIZE Foundation, overlaid a technology infrastructure and crowdsourcing to allow corporations and philanthropists globally for significantly less than $1 million to use our platform to solve whatever problem they're passionate about. We spend all of our time thinking about the world we want to live in and raise our children in, and we're investing our time and our capital to do something about it. If you'd like to join us, please come find me afterwards.
I note that we don't seem to have an equivalence of women to men in this room. I guess that's an unfortunate thing, or maybe it just is what it is. Perhaps in the area of pro-social, it's slightly less significant, because I noticed that as one gets closer to the really big human life challenging issues, there is an ascendance of women who I think, other things equal, do understand some of this stuff better. I'd like to ask Kay, if I may, to perhaps answer this question. Why should people invest more in female-led companies, or should they be gender neutral in their decisions? And did we turn on the microphones?
Are these? Yeah. This is on.
Yeah.
Sure. Be happy to answer that, because that's why I started Springboard Enterprises in 2000, to invest behind women in technology and life sciences. At that time, only 1.7% of the $104 billion invested in this country in venture capital went to women. And I said, somebody has to do something about this, because there are very intelligent, forward-thinking women in these sciences, and they're not getting the funding they need. Even today, women are underfunded. They get about 40% less funding for their businesses, but they're very capital efficient because they perform on par or better than men-led businesses in the same categories, and that's according to the Kauffman Foundation that did the research. Women-led companies are more likely to make the transition from startup to sustainability than men-led businesses are, believe it or not. And I have nothing against men. Men are great investors in our businesses, so please, the gentlemen in the room, come and join us. VC firms that invest in women-led businesses have better performance than those that don't, and that's according to the Reuter-Thompson study released. Yet, in spite of these overperforming women entrepreneurs in the life sciences area and in technology, they're underfunded. And this is a great opportunity for investors. Let me give you a little bit of the information about the Springboard Enterprises companies, because to date we have brought 545 companies to market. We have raised $6.5 billion behind these companies. 40% of them are in life sciences, in biotech, devices, diagnostics, and these are not easy fields to come to market with, yet women are overperforming. So it's really very important that we get women to parity in these marketplaces, because they're outperforming. And for investor groups, many of them led by family offices and individuals like PharmaJet, like CureMark, by Joan Fallon, who's bringing a product to market for treatment of autism. Big problems that are being solved in the marketplace by women who see the need for them. And one of the reasons that I am backing Video for Villages, which is taking communications to the third world women and children, is because we know we can really affect their livelihood, the quality of their lives, saving lives. And a lot of our women are engaged in development of vaccines and the like to serve these populations. So, why do I think we should invest more in women-led businesses? Because we're great investment opportunities, and we dramatically outperform the market. 80% of those 545 companies that we brought to market are in business today over the last 15 years. That is twice the national average of all VC-funded businesses. And over a third of them have had positive liquidity events for their investors, including IPOs. So for an investment opportunity, this is the market you should be in.
Thank you. I wonder if we could turn to Josh on the subject of impact investing. Perhaps you could tell us what is it in one sentence, what typifies it, and it's relatively new as a concept. How do we do more of it?
Sure. So my perspective is impact investing has two components. One is it's an investment. Your intent is to get your money back and then some. Two is it's designed to have measurable social impact. Earlier, there was somebody who spoke about the cell phone and asked everyone in the room who had a cell phone. If I had asked that question 20 or 30 years ago, I would have received a much different response. And the people who had cell phones paid $3,000 or $4,000 for these big, expensive bricks. And it was people who were willing to invest in those bricks that led to the answer we got this morning, that everybody has a cell phone in their pocket. I think where we are in the impact investing world is we're selling big, expensive bricks. But fortunately, there are some people, like Liesl, that are buying those bricks with the vision that everybody at some point will have a cell phone in their pocket. And I find that to be incredibly compelling. I think that it's interesting. People always ask about what it takes to unlock the impact investing marketplace. And some of those things that are controlled by entrepreneurs are happening. We're seeing wins in the marketplace with companies like 2U and Opower going public and Nest getting acquired. We're seeing easier access points, lower entry points, and there will be platforms that come about in the marketplace that allow for a broader menu of investable options and better fit. But what I think needs to happen is the investors, the money owners in the marketplace need to collaborate and need to discuss best practices and what works for them. Because it's their money and their interests which will ultimately drive the marketplace. To that end, I'm going to help launch a nonprofit organization called The Impact, which will be a network of family offices globally that are willing to make impact investments, track the impact and financial progress, and share that data with their peers.
Excellent. Liesl, why do you think that family offices, high net worth families perhaps, are particularly adept at impact investing?
Sure. I think that, several years ago when this idea of impact investing, and it sort of has gone through a number of different names, socially responsible investing, mission aligned investing, sustainable investing, sort of whatever you call it. A lot of that sort of started with charitable assets, so foundations looking to align the endowment assets with their mission, maybe screen for, alcohol and tobacco, and sort of call it a day. And foundations also as this sort of positive form of impact investing has come about in the last, 10, 15 years. A lot of foundations have tried to do it as program-related investments to varying degrees of success. It's a little bit difficult and wonky to do program-related investments. But family offices actually have the flexibility that a number of other capital types and asset owners do not have. So one example of an investment that we were able to make it's not in the health sector, it's in housing, where we layered different forms of capital, we think quite successfully, was actually in the U.S. housing market, 2008, 2009, when the bubble burst and there were a number of distressed homes on the market and a ton of these big funds started, snapping them up. And there are some huge ones now. They're creating like rental-backed securities, and we may be in another issue again. But anyway, it was a big market opportunity, and we were interested in investing in some of these funds, but we did not like that they basically had no or negative social impact according to our parameters that we set at the family office. So we found a really small fund, a private equity fund, actually based out of London, that had partnered with a nonprofit called Builders of Hope, which is based in Raleigh, North Carolina. Builders of Hope employs and trains very difficult to employ individuals, so ex-felons, ex-convicts, and at-risk youth. They train them in green rehabilitation, so how to refurbish homes to be more energy efficient. And they've created a management company that contractors hire to refurbish homes. So anyway, this small fund that we decided to invest in partnered with Builders of Hope to do all of the refurbishing of all of the homes that they purchased. Anyway, one thing that's interesting is pretty much all of the big banks that auction off distressed homes give preferential bidding to nonprofits. So because we had a social impact kind of frame to our fund, we got much better product than Colony, than BlackRock, than the other large funds that are out there. And we can track the success of our fund relative to theirs. And a lot of it is due to us getting better product. We also like what Builders of Hope was able to do. We were able to help Builders of Hope expand into new markets because what we did was we invested equity into this fund, and then we gave a low interest loan and a grant to Builders of Hope so that they were able to expand into more of the geographies that we wanted to work in. And so what family offices, now if you were, you know, just a private equity fund, you couldn't really do that. Other LPs wouldn't be happy about it. It would be really complicated. But a family office can do that. You can layer all of these sorts of different capitals in. You can do it if you're looking to product development in the drug market. What is the type of capital that's needed to advance what you're trying to do? And these sort of hybrid forms of capital, I'm starting to see more and more, and the innovators around this are family offices, not necessarily foundations, but often in partnership with funds. And so I think family offices are really, and I think that's why, you know, with the impact that Josh was talking about earlier, high net worth individuals and family offices have that flexible type of capital that we're going to need, that creative thinking that we're going to need to solve these really big problems.
We're going to move into pricey mode because I want to leave enough time to speak to the 179 nations seated here. So let me just quickly ask Brian how impact investing can specifically lead to more affordable, high-quality healthcare or education or environmental services to underserved markets here in the United States.
Yeah, I mean, I want to follow up what Josh and Liesl have been talking about. I think that the impact investing opportunities are about finding and understanding true positive social or environmental impact. And what we've learned from emerging markets is not necessarily how do you take a malaria prevention company into the U.S. We've eradicated malaria here. But it's more about how. How do you find and identify the entrepreneurs with a will to tackle big problems? How do you understand and help the entrepreneur measure and commit themselves to impact through the structuring of the investment? And how do you help them navigate public-private partnerships, which really is something that I think, as Liesl pointed out very well, there is an advantage at both spotting opportunities and navigating them when you have mission-aligned capital as part of your strategy. It attracts the entrepreneurs, it attracts other partners in a way, and I think that that's the key, is to find funds that are adept at both spotting and building great companies while also navigating solving these problems on the public's behalf.
Thank you. And Greg, wrapping up from our panelists before we do the Q&A, what is the relationship between passion capital and impact investing, and how do they work together?
So 11 years ago, Mike Milken talked me out of my own business to start something called Faster Cures. And at the time, I'm sitting by myself wondering, now what do I do, because I'm supposed to change the way we do medical research. And I realized I didn't have to come up with the idea myself. There were people all over the world in foundations that were changing the way we do medical research. And when I pulled them together, 50 of them, into a network, what I discovered was they were using what I called back then, 2004, passion capital. Capital that they were now, it was philanthropic money they were treating as investment capital, using the kinds of screens that an investor would use to look at where to put their money. And they were getting a return, but they were doing it all for a passionate purpose, which was not just the return of capital for further research, but to solve a problem and to develop a therapy. So after the last 10 years, many, many foundations have now started using this. But here's the problem. They're starting things they can't finish. The NIH gives out $30 billion a year to 300,000 people. Last year, the venture capital industry funded 474 biotherapeutic companies. Now, the VC community will tell you that was all the companies that deserved funding. On its face, that is not true. That is a tautology that would flunk you in philosophy 101. So the problem is, how do we match the potential of ideas that come from foundation funding, NIH funding, et cetera, with the capital to sustain them until we find out whether their idea works, not whether their Rolodex works? And that is where impact investing, or what at Polywog we refer to as crowd equity, comes into play, because by democratizing access to capital and venture capital, we not only can raise money for private companies in amounts that are far smaller than was previously required due to a change in the law, but we can also now create public venture funds, and we are, that will invest $100 million that people can invest in for $5,000 in areas they care about. People don't care about pharma, big cap, small cap. They care about Alzheimer's. They care about diabetes. They care about Parkinson's. So we're transitioning from funding broad areas that are basically big companies to letting people invest and fund the vertical areas of healthcare that matter to them. And all of that is part of the big idea, which is we need to transform healthcare from a cost to an asset. Of all the sectors of the economy, only health is treated as a cost and not an asset. You can't hedge it. The CEO of Aetna can't do what the CEO of Kellogg's can do. He can hedge the future of wheat. If you're the CEO of Aetna, how do you hedge the cost of treating diabetes? You don't. So we have to change the financial capital structure in order to change the way we invest in health in order to improve our health.
Right. We have time for two rapid-fire questions. Yes, Chad, sir.
Yes, this question is actually for Liesl and Kay. I've got two daughters and wanted to know what's the advice that you give your portfolio company leaders, women leaders, and what's the best advice you've received?
Well, we in our portfolio of companies, we're very strong on human capital. It is the human capital that we think is extremely important to our company, so we bring a national roster of human capital to these networks of entrepreneurs. And we advise them to use them judiciously and appropriately, but aggressively, because it is the knowledge of all the people that you can bring to your table that really leads you to not only the financial capital, but the business relationships that you need in the marketplace. So that is the advice we like to give our entrepreneurs and what we invest in. And we stay with them for a lifetime. Even when they sell their companies, many of them are serial entrepreneurs, but many of them go on to do other things like entrepreneur in residence at the White House, at NIH, at DARPA. We infiltrate. So we are building our networks.
Lisa? So I'll take the second part of that, the best advice that I've received, and particularly as an investor, is... And as a young woman investor of inherited wealth, which is a very specific type, I understand. But oddly, don't get bullied away from your principles and from the values that you have, and bringing that to the table and leading with that. Sometimes family offices are sort of called the dumb money. Sometimes. Particularly, I have a nonprofit background and bringing that sensibility to for-profit investing. And as a woman who, you know, isn't a financial professional by training, can be a little daunting when you're in a room and you get sort of bullied away from why you think that these are good investments and why you think that actually this is less risky than other people are telling you, why that's important, and why you see 60 years down the road that these are good technologies to get behind and start to understand. And it can be really challenging because a lot of people don't think that way. They think in 3 to 5 year time horizons, and they want to see certain returns that look a certain way in that time frame. And so the best advice I've ever received is to not get bullied sort of into short-term thinking, I suppose.
Right. Last question before passion eating. Yes, ma'am. Finland.
Did it work? Hi, my name is Catherine Kirsch, and I'm a part of a medical device company that's woman-led, actually. And my question orients a bit around that idea of being the undiplomatic entrepreneur that's looking to talk to these often more traditional thinking VCs or family foundations that looking either to give all their money away or to look at 10 times investment back. And so how do you approach on the other side of the table that certain thinking and not trying to be undiplomatic, as was said earlier?
That's to me, because I use the phrase, it's a challenge, but I think that the ability of an entrepreneur to get the attention of whether it's a foundation on the potential impact or an investor on the potential return is a litmus test. And I think that what is required is a level of patience and perseverance. And many of the companies that at Acumen Fund we invested in had in their early days grant funding to help prove out the concept, to make the product viable. It's no different than public funding for early stage science in the biomedical arena, but when it comes to underserved populations, you do have to make a case to a foundation to provide that early stage funding until the business model is proven. So I think you have to shift gears and be as diplomatic as anybody else and as committed to impact on the philanthropic side in the early stages, but build a company that is not a nonprofit, build a company that's capable of making the leap into raising more traditional and heavily scrutinized financial capital.
And Greg, did you want to add?
Just quickly. Don't fall into the trap of thinking that traditional venture capital is going to stay the way it is. It is falling apart. Find your crowd. The biggest change in securities laws since the Depression now allows private companies to advertise to the general public that they're raising money for a private offering. This cannot be overstated how important this is. You could talk about all the seven sins in public, but you couldn't talk about raising money for a medical device company in public until last September. You will find your crowd, and your crowd will be foundations. Your crowd will be crowdfunding platforms like ours, and there are others. But you no longer have to go to the traditional money. Now, when people come to me and they say, why should we raise money on your crowd platform? I say, because you have to. If you had an easy, fast access to money, you don't need to do the crowd platform approach. But if there are only 474 biotherapeutic companies funded by all of VCs last year, the odds of you getting that money is very, very slim. Has nothing to do with how good you are.
So I want to say thank you to our panelists. I think we have moved the ball up the field. I think what we've learned is that it's not just enough having a spark plug. You also need to apply electricity in order to create the spark. And I think we've heard from several of the sources of electricity. I'd also just like to shamelessly plug my keynote presentation tomorrow at 12:30 during lunch, where you will not only hear more about the Medici effect, but also about Henry VIII, great king of the United Kingdom, the last human being who knew everything about everything. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Peter. Peter, thank you very much for moderating such a wonderful and inspiring panel. I know we're running a bit tight for time, but we have the last panel before lunch, which is called Britain's Best Kept Secret. And since time is of the essence, we don't want it to remain a secret. And therefore, I'm going to invite my friend, Dr. Jonathan Sakia, to introduce that panel. Jonathan. Thanks, Lee.
Thank you, Amir. Well, wasn't that an amazing panel, everyone? I thought it was absolutely fantastic. Peter, thanks for a great job. And I hope the panelists aren't going to try and make a dash for the door, because I know there's a lot of people who'd like to talk to them, me among them. Everyone in this room has, of course, heard of Oxford University, which is widely held to be the leading life science university in the world. There may be some other universities who take exception to that, but it's one of the oldest and certainly one of the leading ones. Their standards have dropped substantially recently. They appointed me as an honorary professor, so things have clearly gone pear-shaped in Oxford. But it's a huge privilege for me to be able to introduce some friends from the United Kingdom. And I'm going to let Freddie make those introductions. Those of you who do not know me, you've established I have a speech defect, and I come from overseas. I think there's some wonderful things happening in the United Kingdom. I think there's things that we in America can learn from, and vice versa. And hopefully this panel will initiate that dialogue. So I'm going to hand over to Professor Freddie Hamdi, who's professor and chairman in the Nuffield Department of Surgical Sciences in Oxford University, and he'll introduce the panelists. Freddie.
Thank you very much, Jonathan, for this kind introduction. Yes, you will hear over the next hour. We have curtailed our session by about 15 minutes so that we don't delay you for lunch too much, but you will hear some speech defects, including from myself. Ladies and gentlemen, a very warm welcome to this next debate. It is going to be a proper debate as opposed to a series of speeches and presentations, and I'm deeply privileged and honored to have been asked to chair this panel by Jonathan. I'm doubly privileged to have on the panel my immediate past chief executive, Sir Andrew Cash, and my current CEO, Sir Jonathan Michael, with whom I've been working very closely as his divisional director for surgery at and oncology at Oxford. Jonathan, there are not many meetings that I chair in your presence, and so I'm enjoying this moment immensely, but please don't take revenge next week. Andrew and Jonathan have reinvented secondary healthcare delivery by the hospital trusts at both Sheffield and Oxford and the region. And I'm delighted that they are both here today to share their leadership and visionary skills. I was introduced to Kate only recently, and we met in Oxford only a couple of weeks ago. And I uncovered a very fortuitous and exciting family link that she has with Baylor College, where I'm a fellow at Oxford, but I'll say no more about that. Kate has an incredible track record as a venture capitalist, and her track record speaks for itself, so thank you for being with us. It's a real privilege to have Miles Ayling. Miles is an innovation champion for the NHS. He's the guru who drives innovation for NHS England, the National Health Services, our health provider. Finally, I'm really excited and I'm thrilled to have a fellow surgeon on the panel, no less than Lord Darzi himself. Ah, you're there. He's been an incredible, powerful figure, influential in the British government as past Minister of Health, and I look forward to your contribution now and to your lunchtime speech. So we're here to sell Britain and the United Kingdom as a whole as the place to be for health innovation. And the title is very appropriate, Britain's Best Kept Secrets, Opportunities to Accelerate Innovation Within the National Health Service. I have learned over the years that the British are very good at hiding their lights behind the bush, but things are changing rapidly, dramatically. Let's find out how. So I'm going to turn to you, Miles, first. And if I may, and I'll ask you a few provocative questions. So the whole world has been watching our 65-year-old NHS with a paradoxical mixed feelings of criticism and envy as a challenging model and a bastion of social medicine in the world. Tell us what's changed over the past 10, 20 years so that we can enlighten this perception and adjust it for the audience here, and which is why the very reason why we are here around this table, with pride rather than feeling beaten up. So over to you.
Thank you. I think I'd like to focus on what's changed in the last 5 years rather than the last 10 or 20 years. And like most health economies globally, the NHS is facing a much, much tougher financial climate. If you add to that a growing and ageing population, people living longer in ill health, increasing levels of comorbidities, plus an increase in public expectations and what seems like a never-ending supply of increasingly expensive medical technologies and medicines, the challenge the NHS is facing now is probably the greatest challenge it's faced in its 65-year history. Yet, that basic model of care hasn't changed in 65 years. If you're ill, you go to your doctor. If you're really ill, you go to hospital. And that simply isn't what a 21st century high-quality healthcare system looks like. So, as Einstein said, if you always do what you always did, you'll always get what you always got. And in the case of the NHS, that will be increasing financial pressures and a health system that's increasingly out of touch with the way we lead our lives and how we use technology. So we're going to have to change. What's interesting and what's changed a lot in the NHS and in the public sector in the UK is that we're working with industry to design and deliver that change. And the relationship between the public sector in the UK and industry traditionally has been one of transaction. Industry sells, we buy, and that's about the quality and richness of the conversation that we'll have. And what we're trying to do now is develop relationships based on trust, not transaction. And that's really difficult. It requires a change in culture, requires a change in attitude, and it requires patience. But we're starting to get there. NHS England, which was established a year ago, recently had a new chief executive appointed, held an event with industry, pharmaceutical sector, medtech sector, the SME sector last week. The idea was just to get to know each other, not to transact business, not to discuss policy, not to lobby, not to try and influence, but just to try and get to understand each other's businesses, pressures, opportunities, threats, balance sheets. And it was incredibly successful. And I hope it's an example of more to come. But I think one of the things we have to accept is the NHS historically has been a difficult place to do business. Whether you're a venture capitalist, whether it's commercial or social, whether you're a medtech company, pharmaceutical or an SME, the NHS is a really difficult place to do business. It's made up of hundreds of individual organisations, and doing business hospital by hospital just doesn't work. And that's why we've recently established 15 academic health science networks which cover the entire population of the NHS. We're the first country globally to do that, and those organisations bring together the university sector and academia with payors, providers and industry, and their job is to horizon scan for new ideas, whether that's technologies, medicines or pathways, and get them into use at pace and scale. So you have 15 contact points in the NHS rather than many hundreds. And if that's too many, NHS England has established a one-stop shop for any part of the private, commercial or social enterprise sector wanting to do business in the NHS. So whether you want access to grant funding, whether you want help with research, with regulation, with accessing the NHS market, with prototyping, with developing products, you can come to NHS England. The email address is england.innovation@nhs.net, and we will help you with that. So the phrase we've started using now is the NHS is open for business, and we are quite genuine about that. We want to work nationally and internationally and partner not just with people in the public sector, but with industry, with the third sector and with social enterprise to improve the efficiency and effectiveness of our healthcare system. And that's important for developed economies as well as developing economies.
So rather than leave questions and answers to the end, we will take questions in between so that you don't lose the string of your thoughts. So if you have any questions, please raise your hands and you can speak. But I will continue with Miles by saying that the funding that you provide, Miles, through Innovation and NHS England comes from the NHS. The NHS is funded by the Department of Health. We have an intensive program, as you know, of cost improvement. How is that compatible with investment into innovation? On one hand, we're trying to be more efficient by spending less and do the same work, or even with high quality. But on the other hand, we do require this investment for innovation. How does it square?
I think I'll answer that in two parts. The first part is people assume that innovation is cost additive and always cost additive, and that isn't always the case. In fact, in many cases, it's not the case. If you look, for example, at the developing science of frugal innovation, taking complexity and cost out of new ideas, there's enormous potential not only to improve the quality of care that people receive, but to drive cost out of the system. The second part of the answer is that's why partnerships are so important to the NHS. We do have a limited amount of funding. It's very significant, £120 billion budget annually, but that is just about covering the pressure that the NHS faces to deliver high quality care for all. Yet there are thousands and thousands of people in the NHS, which employs in total 1.5 million, that are coming up with fantastic ideas every single day. Our problem isn't in new ideas or inventions, it's in spread, adoption and diffusion. Identifying those game-changing ideas that are really going to deliver improvements in value for money and patient care. We have limited amounts of funding, probably about 50 million in total, which allows us to invest in developing, prototyping and bringing to market those ideas. But for every one that we fund, there's probably at least 10 or 20, if not more, that we're not able to fund, but that we believe has real potential. And until relatively recently, if you were one of those companies and we weren't able to fund you, we could offer little else in the way of support other than just understanding. What we're trying to do now is link up with VCs, whether they're commercial or whether they're social, and other parts of government, so that if there is a fantastic idea that people have developed in the NHS by themselves or with industry that we're not able to fund, we can establish whether or not other people, including VCs, can help invest and fund the development of those ideas. So it's about looking beyond our own immediate budgets. And the way I describe this, I think, at the moment is if you look at the investment in new ideas and small to medium-sized enterprises in the NHS in the UK, the combination of public sector investment and private sector investment, the sum of the parts is greater than the sum of the whole. And we've got to spin that around so that the sum of the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. That's what we're trying to do.
Sally Davis, our Chief Medical Officer and Head of NIHR, every time she stands during our senior investigator meeting for NIHR, she says her main mission is to maintain and indeed increase the NIHR budget from the department, and that our responsibility is to deliver success so that she can justify the expense. And the question I have for you is, how do you measure success in the ventures that you pursue? How do you measure that you are investing the right amount of investment in the right people? Unless you can measure it, you can't judge. So can you tell us more about that?
Absolutely. And again, this comes back to my point about partnerships. Traditionally, the way we would have measured investment, either through NIHR or other programmes in the public sector, is whether or not we spent the money. It's quite often that simple. Have you made a grant? Where did it go? Was it spent within that particular accounting year? And then we may develop case studies, particularly if there was a very successful idea or invention that we invested in. And clearly that has got to change. We simply don't currently have the measures or the metrics to identify not only whether the individual investment has returned value for money for the NHS, but whether or not we're having an impact on the economy and driving economic growth. And it was interesting to hear in earlier speeches the point made about health being seen as a cost. It is, and it has been globally. And there's a growing consensus in the UK that we can no longer just think about health and healthcare as a net debtor to the economy. It's got to be a contributor, both in terms of working age and workforce productivity, but also investing in small to medium-sized enterprises and industry, locally, regionally and nationally. But in order to do that, you need far better metrics, and that's what we're trying to learn in part from partnerships with industry.
For those of you who are not familiar with how the NHS functions, it is complicated, but it's one of very few countries in the world where you go in as a patient entitled to be treated, and you can stay in one day or 3 months. You will not be billed. The treating physician will not necessarily know how much it has cost to treat you. And this is becoming almost unique as a system of healthcare provision. And that's the challenges that we are facing. So to have innovation embedded within this is both an opportunity, but it's a double-edged sword as well. And we have to, if you want to make a comment on that.
I think, Freddie, just to add to that, it can be even more perverse that in some cases, if you introduce an innovation into the NHS, you can actually lose income. So despite the fact that you're improving the quality of care and maybe taking cost out of the system in the long run, because of the way money flows around the system, you can lose income in the short term. So there are some deep-rooted structural changes that we need if we're going to shift culture and align financial incentives so that it encourages people to innovate rather than to maintain the status quo.
Okay, thanks, Miles. Any questions for Miles before we move on? Yes, please. I can't see your country. It's not working. You just say who you are, please. Thank you.
Can we hear this? Yep. Hi, James Carroll from Thor Photo Medicine. I've got a speech impediment as well. First of all, it's just encouragement to everybody who's thinking of taking their technologies to the UK. I just made a visit to NICE, that's now the National Institute of Health and Care Excellence, that's what we're calling it this week, and was very encouraged by how easy they made it for us to get in and see them and have a preliminary meeting. So I'd encourage everybody to go and actually have that meeting with them. They loved what we had to offer, which was an oncology product. But they didn't have, exactly as you were saying, they didn't have the data. We couldn't find out how much money we were going to save the NHS. They didn't have the basic data for that. And so I would really like to see some more hand-holding, because we actually have to go and work out the costs ourselves to do that. And also then the next thing you need is you still need the equivalent of an American thing with a kind of a reimbursement code as well. And anything you can do to help us smaller businesses find the data or to generate the data and get the reimbursement would be very useful.
Thank you. Any other comments from Mike?
Respond to that.
Yeah, please.
Well, it's great to hear that NICE were so receptive to your approach, but it goes back to the point I made about the sum of the parts being greater than the sum of the whole, that there are lots of pockets of, or there are organisations in the NHS landscape that can help you with lots of different things, but they're quite fragmented. And what we're trying to do at the moment is stitch them all together so that you can have a single conversation irrespective of what you need, whether it's grant funding, whether it's regulatory approval through NICE, whether it's help with evaluation. So if you catch up with me later, I'll give you my card. But the Innovation Connect I mentioned earlier is designed to do just that, so we can have a conversation with you about how we might help get the evaluation that you need for NICE. There's also something we've introduced called medical innovation briefings. And NICE hate me describing it this way, but it's almost a NICE light, where you're not looking for the gold standard evidence that NICE always develop, but you're looking at available evidence and saying, is this technology potentially so significant that you can make a decision about commissioning it based on available evidence? They were introduced last year for the first time. We're piloting four, and we hope to expand that program. So again, it's trying to tailor a program that suits particularly SMEs.
I think just to add that, the richness that we have in the UK is our patient base and our ability to produce evidence. We have very sophisticated systems for health services research. And just to give you an example, we are conducting in the UK a study which probably will not be conducted anywhere else in the world, and that's the largest randomized controlled trial of treatment effectiveness in early screen-detected prostate cancer. When NIHR and HTA Health Technology Assessment realised how important it was, they've invested no less than £39 million just on a single study over a period of 15 years. And that shows the kind of link and connections and understanding we have with the UK National Health Service and Department of Health and NIHR. Was there a question there? Yeah, please.
Encouraged in the same way to take rapid action for a study, and the regulators that we met with were very supportive. But linking the two together, as you referred, how do we find that capital to expand the study to Europe, and who do we talk to do that in Europe? There was never a mention of that. We did get some feedback on YLG, Year Life Gained, and considerations that we would have to discuss with economic interests, but there was no further direction. It was lovely and encouraging, but nothing else happened.
What we've realized recently is the traditional method of sharing, disseminating information across the public sector just doesn't work for the partnerships we're trying to develop. So it's okay saying knowledge amongst the 1.5 million people in the NHS is improving, and we need to make more of them aware about some of these opportunities. But we've got to work through the trade associations as well. So in the UK, the ABHI, the ABPI, Diagnostics, and others, the CBI as well, the Confederation of Small to Medium-Sized Enterprises. So they all know if they're approached nationally or internationally by small, medium-sized enterprises or by multinationals that want to access the NHS, and they're struggling to understand how, you can go to Innovation Connect and NHS England will help you.
So I think there's an important message here that there's more connection and more clarity that we need to find. I'll move us on. Kate, I'm going to come to you. So as a venture capitalist, very successful, we met a few weeks ago and you gave me absolutely wonderful examples of success. But the perception is that somehow you sit on the other side of the fence if you look at academia or the NHS. Tell us why you would advise investors to come to you or to the UK to build their portfolio.
Okay, so thank you. I invest through SV Life Sciences. I just do therapeutic investing. And as part of preparation for this panel, took a look at what's our record been. So we've invested over $100 million into UK headquartered companies. We've returned, getting on for 3 times our cash, and returns, depending on which period and different things, somewhere north of 30% IRRs. So the first reason, as you come to the UK, is because you can make a lot of good investments. We have backed big life-changing drugs such as Humira, Velcade, Campath. So these are drugs that treat cancer, arthritis, blindness, and those have been developed in the UK. So the first reason you'd come is because of you can make good money. The second thing, and you will have heard this a lot of times, but the UK has a phenomenal medical science research base. As part of the introduction, I mean, Oxford has come top of the Times educational higher education rankings in medical sciences for the last 2 years. And it's not just Oxford,
three
it's
years.
London, Oxford,
three
Cambridge.
Years.
Oh, 3 years. Sorry, I'm out of date.
We might as well brag about it because it may not last.
Yeah, exactly. So it is... And really, if you take sort of London, Oxford, Cambridge, and the universities in that region, we have got 4 of the top 10 global universities. And actually, inventions are almost directly, and patents are almost directly linear to medical research funding. So the more academic research there is, the more IP and patents that come out of it. So in terms of being a rich place in which to hunt for new innovations that are going to help with delivering improved healthcare, it's a good place to start. As an example, Institute of Cancer Research down in Sutton is probably the most productive non-profit centre in terms of developing new drugs. So they have generated 16 oncology candidates over the last 6 years, including abiraterone, which J&J has launched with peak sales estimated at $1 billion. And Wellcome Trust, as a huge big funder, a charitable funder in the UK, has developed some huge big programs. It started off with coordinating the human genome sequencing in the public side. They're now doing the Cancer Genome Project. So that's taking 50 different cancers and sequencing 25,000 genomes of the cancer. So we've got some good examples of cooperation and big science and big thinking going on in the universities. But just building on what Miles has said, I mean, we do have a biobank, which is taking 500,000 people across the UK and basically measuring absolutely everything about them so that these guys will be... It first started about, I think, 2010, that's when they first got the 500,000. But they're going to be stratified and examined over everything until they die. And it will produce a phenomenal long-term medical resource for investigators to go and have a look. and see what they can learn. But specifically as far as the NHS is concerned, and this is an area that I don't think came out enough, actually, in Miles, what you were talking about and how that relates to me, is we are able now to work in the UK environment through the NHS and through what they call NIHR, which stands for National Institutes of Health Research. So it's sort of similar to over here, where you can submit a protocol and you can get within 2 weeks a response back to, is this protocol delivered for a clinical trial in the UK? And if it is, these are where the patients are, because we've got national medical records and they're largely electronic at hospital level. So we know the incidence of patients. We know the granularity of disease sufficiently that we can start testing inclusion and exclusion criteria. And we know the investigators of the about 1,100-1,200 investigators that are part of the clinical trial network in the UK. We know the performance of those investigators in delivering high-quality clinical trials. Now, for a little company, which is what we back, that is phenomenally rich data, because we're not having to negotiate with hospital by hospital and everything. We have model agreements, we know where the patients are, and we know the performance of the investigators, and we have electronic health records. So it's a huge, huge advantage. And in the UK, just as a final pitch for the UK, I guess, is we now have a pretty supportive government that is quite keen on this as an industry where we can perform. So we've got great... I mean, this is one of the reasons I'm sure you're reading in the newspapers about Pfizer and AZ. One of the reasons is it's a tax argument for Pfizer to come based in the UK because of the opportunities that we are now offering companies in this area. So I think as a UK citizen, but also somewhere to invest, it is hugely rich, and we simply don't have enough cash or people or entrepreneurs to help develop the resources we've got. But we do have the systems now to enable a very effective proof of concept for different opportunities.
Any questions for Kate? Kate, when I was a surgical trainee or surgical resident, as you would say here in the US, there was a misconception that we should not work with industry, that it's unclean to do that. Do you think this has changed?
I think it's completely changed, and I'll give you an example. So one of our companies is developing drugs, now therapeutics, for age-related hearing loss and tinnitus. Now, to begin with, that's a big deal, because mostly the devices, the opportunities to deal with hearing loss are hearing aids, where you can turn up the volume, but it doesn't deal with speech discrimination. So how do you have the cocktail party conversation and actually understand, without lip reading, what the person you're talking to is saying? It gets increasingly difficult as you get older. Work that's come out of academia has started looking at basically what's brain deafness. So how do you process the signals even as you get older? And without working with academia, we wouldn't have any... we had no basis for actually exploring the biology. And then going forward in terms of working with academia, and specifically in tinnitus, this is a highly complicated disease. And without absolutely the best brains from the research side as well as the clinical side, and actually being able to identify where the patients are and so on, we simply wouldn't be able to progress this. So I think it's a big opportunity. 20 years ago when I joined, for sure it was harder to talk to clinicians, and they would like to publish before they spoke to me, but now I think the world has changed.
Thank you. So you quoted, when we spoke last time, you quoted some extraordinary figures about investment with huge differences between the UK in total and just the area of Boston.
So if you take the what I call the sort of golden triangle of London, Oxford, Cambridge, the medical research science base in that region in the UK is broadly similar to the greater Boston area with Harvard and MIT and so on. Yet in America, in the greater Boston area, more than $2 billion of private capital is raised per year to support that medical research, compared with a quarter. So $500 million is raised in the UK. I mean, it's appalling, and there's no question that the London, Oxford, Cambridge academic prowess is absolutely as strong, I would argue stronger, than the greater Boston area, and yet we've got less than a quarter of the money there to exploit it. So in terms of sort of impact investing and ability to find opportunities, we've certainly got them.
Okay, any comments, questions? No, I mean, I think Britain is changing rapidly, and money wasn't spoken about, it is. Sex wasn't spoken about, now it is. I'm not going to talk about sex, whether it's in Britain or in space, but things are changing. Ara, if I can turn to you now, please. You and I were trained to see patients, to cut them up, to make fast decisions and to save lives. But you decided to go way outside the box and to travel an extra mile or two. Why did you do that in the context of what we're speaking today?
Well, my cuts were very small, and so I had to look for bigger incisions to make to have a wider impact. And may I just say, it wasn't my idea waking up one morning and saying, I want to be a health minister. There was a recognition out there that policy had to be evidence-based. Policy had to be led by people who know what it means. How do you translate? We talk about translational research in medicine. We spend huge sums of money to do clinical trials. If we spend 10% of that in doing translation of evidence into policy, I think the yields will be greater, and I will be saying something about that at lunchtime. What are the major challenges facing us in terms of policy and reform? Because you are as good as the system that you work in. I think some very eloquent things have been said about the UK, and I will add to those. It's not that the UK now is getting its act together. The UK has an amazing legacy. If you look at the last 50 years, 40% of the major innovations actually did come up from the UK. The Mansfield, the MRIs, the antibiotics, absolutely. Where I work, the challenge we've had in the UK is translating that into clinical practice, and that is what's new, and that is what I aspire to do while I was in office. And innovation was very much not within the taxonomy or the language of political language or policy language. And how do you accelerate the uptake of innovation? How do you close the gap between what we know and what we do? Is something that I've always had an aspiration to do. As long as you don't get contaminated with the politics of it, I think you could leave and finish the big operation without any complications.
So you're a phenomenal ambassador for the UK and you're globetrotter, but how do you convince people when you go out? What do you tell them?
I think Kate said most of it. If I could just say, life sciences industry is worth about 4.3% of our GDP. And that is growing and it's getting bigger. I think we've covered most of the incentives that you have in investing in the UK. We still have some of the best brains. We still have I think you mentioned the point, you know, we have access to our population unlike any other country. We have a unified patient record. Kate said, we have a number of disease research networks. You want to do a research in diabetes, you have a very large network, which is run out of Oxford and Imperial. You have access to that. You have access to the diabetic population in the NHS. And I could go on and on and on in relation to that. When it comes to the tax advantages, we have a so-called the patent box, which gives you a corporation tax of 10%. That is becoming more and more attractive. The return of investment from a UK perspective, I think we spend 1.7% of GDP on research. We are actually the seventh, so that's not a very good score, but there's another way of looking at it. In actual fact, we are the second to the US when it comes to citations and number of patents. So we're doing something right
for less money.
So the amount of output you get per dollar spent here versus per pound spent in the UK is extremely attractive. So there are many, many opportunities in the UK, and there are issues within the National Health Service. I'll try to address those in my talk later. We could do better there. I mean, it doesn't look good to someone who's investing in which your own health service is not taking up the innovations that you're investing in. So in many ways, that doesn't come across well. But we're working on that, Miles said, and a number of others said. I mean, and again, it depends on the organizations that you're working in. May I just remind you, the NHS is not an organization. It's a system. Within that system, there are many, many organizations who are leading innovators in the country. So, you know, come over to the UK, you will see the advantages of investing in the UK, which are phenomenal.
Strong message there. One final question for you, R. You still operate, like me, and you still train young people. How are you changing their culture from the culture that you and I received? What do you do practically?
You know, culture eats any strategy for breakfast, as we say. And, you know, that culture of entrepreneurship, that culture of what is possible, which is really what is the buzz in this country, you know, that is slowly transfecting the English, if I could use that word. And I think you need to start at a lower level.
What do you do personally?
Well, what we have is to challenge your beliefs on a regular basis, challenge what you're practicing, look at possibilities and opportunities of changing practice. And I think in many ways is role modeling and who are the role models in the system. And I think in many ways, you know, innovation isn't just the next new blockbuster drug that's going to have an impact. The potential of creating value in any health system, including the United States, in coming up with simple innovations, process innovations, new business models. You know, we're struggling in how do you stimulate new designs, new entrants into the marketplace in delivering. We talk about mobile telephony today. You know, how do we disrupt the incumbent, which is a big challenge in this country, and we have exactly similar challenges in the UK. The one thing I'd like to address is the question, which is where do we go to address that? That's something we're working on, and you may or may not know, in London recently, our very charismatic mayor, Boris Johnson, launched MedCity. And MedCity is that door that you knock, and I very much hope that experience will change for those of you who have a desire of visiting London, at least.
And before you leave, we will have a list of the best restaurants in London, and they are competing with your best restaurants in New York, I know by experience. So the statements we heard yesterday were actually a lot of rubbish, excuse me. With all due respect to the wonderful speech we had from Craig. Food is excellent in the UK. Thank you. That was terrific. Andrew, I've witnessed you engineering a phenomenal merge of two large trusts in Sheffield, and you transformed secondary healthcare delivery in the region. And, you know, I was really happy when my time at Sheffield, and the only reason I moved is it was difficult to resist the call from the dreaming spires of Oxford. So can you share your experience of this transformation, not just for Sheffield, but for the whole region, South Yorkshire, which is very, very large, and in particular the impact of the changes in the context of what we're discussing today?
Well, I think it's very important to realise that the National Health Service is a system, as Ara has said, and in the English National Health Service, there are 220 hospitals, and the first thing I'd say is about 130 of those hospitals are now called foundation hospitals, and as a foundation hospital, you run your own affairs. And you run your own affairs to do three things, really. Firstly, to provide services to patients. Secondly, to educate your staff as they're coming through in their various professional training. And thirdly, to provide research and innovation. And I can't stress enough the importance of the status of foundation trusts, where you have freedom to operate. And certainly in my career is probably organizationally the biggest single legal reform that we have. So that's the first thing. And then the second thing I'd say that has happened is we do realize that we have to transform, as Miles was saying, not transact. It's been a little bit too slow the way we take on things and make things happen. And The way we are decluttering the landscape and making it easier for business to work with us is through those 220 hospitals organizing themselves into 15 networks. My own network, one of the 15, is in Yorkshire and Humber, covers 6 million population, 22 hospitals, 9 universities, and many hundreds of small, medium enterprises and large industry. And our main aim in this Yorkshire and Humber network, one of the 15, is, I think, two main aims. The first is to improve health, the health of the population of the 6 million people we serve. And the way we're doing that is to take 5 or 6 high-impact innovations, things that are proved to have worked. And yet, in the past, we've known these things have worked. We've known a good drug has come in, yet it's taken, frankly, years to get that implemented across all the organizations very quickly. So we're doing that. And secondly, some known technology, besides the kind of high-impact innovations, there are just a few of them every year. Besides that, we have the National Institute for Clinical Excellence, at NICE it's called, it's quite well known. Again, we do technology assessments of things, and again, they're not implemented uniformly across the organizations. So we realize we've got to focus the system to do a few things in a better way. So that's improving health. And the second mission of the Academic Health Science Network is to increase wealth. And what this is about is recognizing our responsibilities to connect health, the hospitals, with the universities, with industry. And it's so important that we make this connection. And just one example in South Yorkshire that we're growing in wealth creation is that recently the University of Sheffield, where Freddie was before he made his fateful mistake to go to Oxford, but the University of Sheffield is very good at engineering. Now, engineering attracted Boeing to come to Sheffield in a new park because they were very good at composite engineering and making composites, and they've relocated their landing gear R&D section there because the landing gear can be made 10 times the strength at 10 times less the weight. Now, a number of pavilions have gone up, research pavilions have gone up there in South Yorkshire, looking at those, and once you get a very big company, of course they bring 40 or 50 supplier type companies with them. The next pavilion that's going up is on medical technology innovation, a medical technology innovation centre. We're very keen to do exactly the same targeted approach with the medical technology industry. And that's just an example, I think, of how the NHS is trying to change to create wealth. And by the way, you're now dealing with 15 organisations, not a very complicated system, or 220 hospitals. Each has an international office, and I think each is ready for business now.
Thank you very much, Andrew. That's great. So my next comment or question was that there is a perception that Westminster money and money in general flows more to the south of England than to the north. And knowing the successes of Sheffield University, as you described, Boeing, knowing the financial stability and success of the trust that you engineered, I'm always opposed to that conception. Can you comment just in a
well,
minute?
I think there is a spectrum. On one end of the spectrum is world-class research, and we must have a few centres that practice world-class research, and as things are developed there, they are quickly implemented in the rest of the service. The other end of the spectrum is more of an innovative dealing with assistive technology, things, areas such as this. Now, one thing that the north of England is doing is it's four of the 15 academic health science networks. They're coming together, and we're creating something called the Northern Health Science Alliance, and that has the eight big universities in the north and the eight major teaching centres or hospitals, teaching hospitals. And that covers a population that is, I think it's about nine to 11 million, something like that, a big population, bigger than Scotland, bigger than Wales. And that is working together. We formed our own organisation there. And in fact, we have one international office for the four networks. That way, I think, as long as we are working in cooperation with the academic health science centres, which tend to be in the Golden Triangle of Oxford, Cambridge and London in the south, as long as we're making sure those discoveries are quickly translated and put into other parts of the country, it works very well, I think.
Yeah, I just want to endorse that, because ever since I left, I kept a visiting professorship in Sheffield. We continue to work together very closely, and there's absolutely no reason why North-South can't meet and do wonderful things together. So I just want to echo. Thank you. Jonathan, I'll move to you. We bragged about Oxford a lot. I will brag a little more. It is an institution which is 1,000 years old, and as Kate said, the biomedical sciences has been topping world ranking for the past 3 years. But it's incredibly resistant to change. The joke is, how many Oxford dons, and Oxford don is a senior academic, well-established, how many Oxford don does it take to change a light bulb? Does anyone know? The answer is change. Oxford does not like change. So in that climate, I have seen an extraordinary transformation ever since you became chief executive of the trust 4 years ago. And one of the most remarkable changes, which may sound trivial, but I absolutely think it is not, is the brand from the Oxford Radcliffe Hospitals Trust to the Oxford University Hospitals. So tell us why you did it, what the significance of that change is in the context, again, of what we're discussing today.
Well, as you say, when I moved to...
Do we have a microphone, please?
When I moved to Oxford, I inherited one of the largest of the NHS organisations, but perhaps, or certainly not one of the most effectively performing, but also a relationship with one of the top 10 universities in the world, and as already been said, the top medical faculty in the world. These were separate organisations that were working together, but not very effectively. And in discussion with my opposite number at the university, Andy Hamilton, we recognised that in fact there was a missed opportunity in as we were making the best of what was available with a very large healthcare provider, a good population base, and really strong research and academic base. And so, as part of an agreement between the two organisations, there has been quite a lot of, over the years, effort in the NHS to actually see whether a form of integrated governance between universities and hospital trusts, which is a model which is seen more commonly in North America, is actually possible. But actually, NHS trusts and universities are separate legal entities in the UK, and the attempts to move to a single integrated governance structure have not been particularly successful. And so what we decided to do in Oxford was, in fact, to recognise there were two separate legal entities that have got their own responsibilities, own organisations, own governance, but actually have a very, very significant shared interest in areas not only in clinical care, education and training, but also in research, development and innovation. And so what we did was to set up a formal legal partnership between the two organisations, and at that point we changed the name of the NHS organisation to reflect the closeness to our university partners, so it became Oxford University Hospitals. As you say, you probably understand more than I do. To me, that was a fairly logical thing to do, but I perhaps didn't quite understand the arcane nature of the governance arrangements within Oxford University, and to link the university to such a high-risk venture as a healthcare provider was something which took some digestion by the professors of divinity and the humanities who didn't perhaps see
all
the advantage.
Changing the bulb, you see, that's what it's
about. So that's how it came about.
Yeah, that's great. Thanks. So can you give the audience some examples of this tripartite, very precious partnership? University of Oxford, NHS organisation, industry, government, charities, philanthropy, and I have a particular example in mind. So do you want to elaborate on that a little?
Yes, if we just talk a bit about the strong research base in Oxford. I mean, there's a lot of NHS-funded R&D activity going on in Oxford with biomedical research centres, biomedical research units looking at particular areas, musculoskeletal disease, dementia. We coordinate a research network covering the whole of the Thames Valley and South Midlands, and then have also a role in also a collaboration and leadership in health research and care. One of the academic health science centres in the country, which is obviously we've talked about before, linking basic science to translational medicine. And although those are predominantly based in the South and in the Golden Triangle, one shouldn't forget that Manchester has a passing interest in academic health science centres, and it's a little bit further north than Oxford. So enormous opportunities. An example of a project that we're developing at the moment between the university, industry, and the trust is an attempt to develop a personalised cancer medicine research institute, which is a very exciting opportunity to link early stage intervention in cancer treatment with particle beam therapy, chemotherapy, interventional surgery that you know more about than I do. So, and that's it's not there yet, but it's an example of the opportunities that we have and are building on.
So there is, I think, again, just to clarify to the audience, we've got a BRC, we've got an Academic Health Sciences Centre, we've got an Academic Health Sciences Network. What does all that mean?
Well,
in a nutshell.
I mean, if you come back to Andy's discussion of the Academic Health Science Network in Sheffield, the Oxford Academic Health Science Network covers a slightly smaller population of around sort of 4 million, but within that geography there are more than 500 healthcare and life science organisations. And there are, including many major companies, and over 300 life science businesses. The NHS in our part of the world spends £5 billion a year and employs 65,000 people. And there are some really exciting, not directly linked organisations that actually facilitate that sort of innovation. Formula One. A lot of the world's Formula One companies are actually based in the Thames Valley. So Formula One technology and engineering is there. There are a grouping of big science and other research facilities also adjacent to Oxford, with the UK Atomic Energy Authority, the Cullum Centre for Fusion Energy, the Science and Technology Facilities Centre, the Rutherford Appleton Laboratory. So Harwell and things like that. There are lots of opportunities for companies that are engaged. And in fact, if you look at slightly wider than Oxford in the Thames Valley and the Science Vale, there are probably 1,500 tech firms on a conservative estimate, with a strong focus on research and development.
So, thank you, Jonathan. I would like to finish by asking each of you to give me one line. Why should our people in the audience, why should they go next week and buy a ticket to come to England, land in London, maybe pay a visit to ARA, but certainly turn left and come to Oxford? So why, what can we tell them to make them go and buy a ticket online very quickly? Miles.
We have fantastic intellectual, physical, research, data and population assets. We've woken up to the fact that they're hugely valuable, not only commercially, but in terms of improving healthcare. We now have a system that recognises that and has many fewer contact points for those wishing to partner with us. Come and join us.
Thank you. Kate?
I mean, it's largely the same. We've got an unexploited, world-class research, medical science research institutions with insufficient funding to exploit them, but a system that allows a very well organised clinical trials to take place you know where the patients are and you know the quality of the trials you can run, which massively speeds up the ability to develop that into proof of concept medicines.
Jonathan?
I'd do it in one word: opportunity.
Andrew?
Well, it should be easier, much easier now to do business. And that was always the feeling before, is that people found it very difficult to find their way in. It should be very easy now to do business.
Ah.
You'd also have fun. England is a lovely place, and we have the Queen.
That's a wonderful note to end with. I do want to highlight that we are planning for another Cavendish Forum to host it in Oxford. We'll let you know details in due course. You'll all be very, very welcome to attend. We will circulate details when they are available. And I just want to thank again the organisers, the panellists who've been wonderful, very consistent, and there was very little stage preparation, I must absolutely confess. So what you have seen is what you will get. Thank you very much indeed.
Ladies and gentlemen, maybe invite you for lunch. If you were to take that door and make a left, then down the passageway, all the way down, you'll see people helping you get to the delegates' dining room. Walk along East River, and then underneath some scaffolding, come to the elevator bank. There are four elevators. It'll take you to the fourth floor. We look forward to seeing you there shortly. Thank you.